Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Cathode Ray Mission. I'm your host, Adam Farron, and tonight our topic of discussion is John Ford and his top 10 films. Joining me for discussion are Sammy Giuliano. Say hello.
Hello, hello.
Gregory Runfeld, say hello.
Hello.
And Joseph McBride, please say hello.
Hi there, guys. Good to be with you. I'm having a little trouble with my interference on the line here, by the way.
Yeah, I was wondering if that. I was just about to say that literally just started. Is everybody else hearing that?
Yep, I'm hearing it too. Yep.
You're hearing it too? Okay, we may have to, if that persists, nope, it seems to be done. The vagaries of live radio, we sometimes have weirdness at the beginning on Blog Talk. There, it's done. About a year ago, Greg and Joe and I did a show on Ford where we did an overview of his career. And we decided at the end of that show that we hadn't gone into some of his films in enough depth. However, we promised ourselves and the audience that we would eventually do a top 10 episode. And that's what tonight is, our look at our top 10 Ford films, a chance to do more than, say, a minute on some of the truly greatest films ever made. So the way that tonight is going to work is we're going to do it old Siskel and Ebert style, the countdown style, where, for example, if I was to begin, I would list my number 10, the next person would list their number 10, the next person would list their number 10, and then the last person would list their number 10. So when we're all done with number 10, we'll then move on to our number 9. When we're all done with our number 9, we'll move on to our number 8, and in that way count up to number one. So before we really begin in earnest, Joe has actually written, well, more than a few books, and about, what is it, three on John Ford, or is it just the
well,
two?
Well, two on John Ford, a critical study with Michael Wilmington in 1974, and it's called John Ford, and a biography that I wrote called Searching for John Ford in 2001.
Mm-hmm. Both of which are excellent. I have copies on my shelf of both.
Thank you.
The one
I have them
one,
too.
was quite interesting. You know, especially for a slimmer volume, it's quite rich.
Thank you. Yeah, we were proud of that one. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, we're also probably, if we get a chance, we're going to go in a little bit on some of our underrated Ford films. We'll see how that goes. So, without further ado, and hopefully this buzzing doesn't continue because it's starting up again, unfortunately, we will begin with our number 10. And I will go with you, Joe. So what is your number 10 John Ford film?
Well, I like to try to stick to the rules, but I have two films that I can't choose from for number 10, so I'll just throw them out there. One is How Green Was My Valley, 1941, the last film Ford made before he went to war. And his war documentary, The Battle of Midway, which he made in 1942, filming it during the actual battle. Great short film.
Yeah, Midway is a film that I appreciate without exactly loving. I love documentaries, but I think when it comes to Ford, I've always been much more attracted to his narrative work. How Green Was My Valley is a film that I actually have a little bit higher on my own list, but I love it. So what is it that you really like most about How Green Was My Valley?
It's a very It's a film that sums up Ford's view of the world, and I think he intended it that way because he was going to war. He was in the U.S. Naval Reserve, and he worked in naval intelligence from 1934 onward. He knew the war was coming, and he was he had a photo unit, field photo unit that he had set up where he was training Hollywood personnel to film combat. And he was, every week they'd meet at Fox and they'd go through training and drills, et cetera. And so he was all set to go, and he, you know, he thought he may never come back. This might be his last film. And it ends in the afterlife, which is remarkable. It's a based on a Richard Llewellyn novel about a Welsh coal mining family. And my ancestors were coal miners and silver miners, Irish immigrants to America. So I feel, you know, a great connection there, because if my mother had not gotten a scholarship to go to Marquette University, I probably would have become a coal miner, and I wouldn't be here because I would have died of black lung disease years ago. It's really the worst job in the world. And
it is.
Hal Greenwood's My Valley has the prototypical Ford theme of the breakup of a family and the collapse of a community. Ford was always mourning those subjects, partly because his parents came from Ireland. They left because of the Great Famine, and there was a great homesickness that he picked up from his parents, and that radiates through his entire body of work. So this film really is a gem of direction. And a profound film, a very deeply moving, probably has one of the greatest child performances in film history. Roddy McDowall plays the protagonist, Hugh Morgan. And Ford felt the film was autobiographical, which is interesting because it's based on another man's novel. And Llewellyn claimed it was autobiographical, but some people have challenged that and claimed that he made it up, you know. But in any case, Ford could relate to being the smallest child or one of the smallest children in a large family, and dealing with he romanticizes the mother figure in his films. The father is stern but lovable, and it deals with labor relations. Ford was very involved in that in Hollywood, and so it's in his it's kind of a mixture of left and conservative values. It's Philip Dunn wrote the screenplay, and actually Dunn wrote the screenplay for William Wyler to direct, and Ford didn't change it very much. So it's an interesting case of the auteur theory that you can have a book written by somebody else with a screenplay written by somebody else that you don't change very much, and yet still make it your own visually, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's a powerful film, and amazingly tragic. It's so sad. I mean, I didn't quite realize for a long time how deeply tragic it is when Hugh decides to give up a prep school scholarship and go into the mines like his father. It's really a tragic decision. And so it ends in ruination. But Ford sends the audience out with a kind of a emotional upswing by showing the characters in the afterlife, in a sense, but they're all dead, you know, the people he's showing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm going to then throw this to our other participants tonight. So I will go to you, Sammy. What do you have to say on How Green Was My Valley?
Well, I have that way high up in the top three. That's one of my favorite films of all time. First of all, I'll say it lives in infamy with many people because it's the film that beat Citizen Kane for the Best Picture Oscar. So for years, decades, in fact, people do give it short shrift because how could a film like that, this sentimental, lyrical movie, beat out, one of the most influential masterpieces in movie history? My argument has always been, in its own right, it's a masterpiece. It's a great film. Is it a better film than Citizen Kane? Maybe not. But I watch it more often than I watch Citizen Kane, and I think it was a worthy winner in 1941. I think what happened there was the Grapes of Wrath did not win in 1940. The Best Picture prize went to Rebecca, even though Ford copped the Best Director. So that the following year, there was maybe sentiment in his corner, and people just didn't understand, you know, Citizen Kane in the way they do now. And back then, you know, that was a typical Hollywood production, very sentimental, very, very moving, tear-wrenching film. Joseph handled, you know, talking about all the particulars of it, but the performances, he mentioned McDowell and Donald Crisp, and, you know, across the board, you know, the beautiful cinematography, the score, the set design. I have a friend that, my late friend Alan Fish, always would argue with me and tell me that he thought that he liked some things about the film, but he thought the accents were wrong. He thought those were not Welsh accents. He'd always argue with me on that point, but I thought that was besides the point. I mean, it worked for what it was, and it's the kind of film you could watch over and over. Just the opening narration, you know, that beautiful lyrical narration talking about people long gone. Again, Joseph alluded to that in his presentation. It's one of my favorite movies of all time by any director. Much less Ford, it ranks in my top three. I have it here at number three, but there are some days of the week I would even elevate it to number one. But right to this show, I have it listed at number three. It's just a movie I adore. I adore. I don't know what else to say.
Can I add something?
At the time.
Points are well taken.
I will need to pause the show here for just a second, fellas. I think I've discovered the cause of the interference. I think it's a bad connection for you, Gregory. So could you hang up, please, and call back, and hopefully your line is
actually,
better.
Yeah, actually, you know, let me call you back. I'm on my landline. Let me call you back on my mobile, okay?
Okay, please do. Please do.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
Okay, that's very unusual, but I figured it out. There's sometimes a way that Blog Talk will let you figure it out if it's actually there's like three or four troubleshooting things, and I was like, uh-oh. So Greg gets his chance to discuss How Green Was My Valley. I think we'll go back and you can talk a little bit, Joe, about Midway, since you do have two at number 10. So why don't we go to Midway, and you can talk about Midway a little bit, and then Sammy can talk about that.
Yeah. I just want to add a couple things to what Sammy said, which were very well taken. I think Wells would have been pleased that Ford won Best Picture in the Year of Kane, because Ford was Wells' favorite filmmaker. He thought he was... He was asked what filmmakers he liked in the 60s. He was asked that question. He said, the old masters, by which I mean John Ford, and John Ford. And How Green Was My Valley opened the same day that the Magnificent Ambersons began filming. And Ambersons has some very direct influences from How Green Was My Valley. So I think Ford
Hold
Ford
on one
Wells,
second. You're back, Greg.
Yeah, can you guys hear me?
Yep, and no interference this time, so please go on, Joe.
So I think it's, they're both great films, and I think people who fret over Kane not winning the Oscar, I mean, who really cares about Oscars anyway, frankly? Ford never showed up to get his Oscars. One time he said he was taken drunk, the way he put it, I like that. But he was proud of them in retrospect. He had four Oscars for Best Director, which more than anybody has ever had. But Battle Midway won an Academy Award for Best Documentary in 1942, and Ford didn't get that. He claimed he won two Oscars for the war documentaries. The other was December 7th, but actually they went to the Navy, but he tried to claim them. But Battle Midway was made during the turning point of the war in the Pacific, which was, you know, the United States was getting hammered by Japan all through the Pacific after Pearl Harbor, you know, in battle after battle. And we had cracked the Japanese code, which people didn't know at the time, of course. And Admiral Nimitz sent Ford to Midway, and he said, you better get there and document what happens. And then when Ford got there, the one of the flyers told him that they were going to be attacked the next day, next morning. And so Ford was there with a 16-millimeter handheld, hand-loaded camera, and he had a young cameraman with him, Jack McKenzie Jr., who he sometimes, Ford sometimes falsely claimed he shot the whole film himself, but McKenzie was with him up on the power station, which is the most dangerous place to be if a base is being attacked. But he was tasked by the commander to report by telephone about Japanese airplanes coming in at the same time he was filming, which is kind of astounding. But he did it, and he got wounded during the battle and got knocked out. And then he and McKenzie ran down. The Japanese planes were bombing and causing a lot of destruction, and Ford just shouted to him, shoot faces, film faces. And Ford filmed this great shot, which Henry Fonda aptly called one of the all-time great shots, of young Marines raising the flag during the battle, during the bombardment of the island. It's a really great shot. Ford filmed that himself.
Yeah.
So it's remarkably vivid, and the public had not seen real combat footage before. And it, not only that, it's in Technicolor, and it caused tremendous reactions in theaters. President Roosevelt saw it and said every mother in America should see the film. So they made hundreds of prints and showed it in theaters, and people were crying and running up the aisles. And it's a very poetic film. It's not a thorough account of the battle, which ranged over several hundred miles in 3-4 days, I believe. And Philip Dunn told me he was in Washington. Ford showed him the Battle of Midway, and Dunn said, well, it's great, Jack, but, you know, the real story of the Battle of Midway was the Japanese lost, I think it was 4 aircraft carriers in a short period of one day, and he said, that's the real story, and you didn't get that. And Ford got understandably angry. He said, okay, you get a camera, and you go out and film the Battle of Midway, you know. But it's a poetic documentary. It's about what it felt like to be in war. The most moving part is the sequence of whose planes crashed into the ocean because of lack of gasoline and had to be rescued sometimes after a week or 10 days, and they're really in terrible shape, and they're being rescued. It's a very moving sequence. So Ford often shows the human toil, a toll of war. His war documentaries tend to be more gung-ho than his narrative films about war. As you mentioned, Adam, the narrative films like Fort Apache and They Were Expendable are more complex in their view of war, but there's an immediacy and a poetic beauty and dread, you know, to Battle of Midway that makes it very powerful.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, you know, you talked about having your number 10 being a double. Mine is a tie as well, and that is Four Sons, which is a silent movie about a woman whose four sons end up in World War I, but not all on the same side. They're German. In particular, they're Bavarian. It is Ford doing expressionism, and it is a phenomenal piece of work. It has a lot of striking images. It has some really fine performances. Yeah, it's got some melodrama in it, but the best kind.
Nothing wrong with melodrama, you know.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, so it's okay. And, you know, it also, it's got some of the, honestly, I think it's got some of the best black and white cinematography I've ever seen. But that's beside the point. But, you know, my other one is John Ford's very last movie, a movie which, you know, I have a lot of friends who are older that are movie fans, and almost to a person, they're like, wait, you actually like Seven Women? But everybody knows it's crap. It's shit. I'm like, have you seen it? No. I'm like, oh.
Yeah.
So you're calling it shit without seeing it. And as I was watching
we'll get to Seven Women, you know, you're
a huge advocate for that film, and that's a great, it's a great final picture from Ford. I think it's one of my top ten, but it is certainly a wonderful picture.
Yeah, and the thing is I've always said that I think part of the reaction to the movie is it was too brave and bold for its time. It actually is a feminist film in a lot of ways. And I think that in the 60s, it was a movie that people were like, oh, my God, this is – Ford's gone soft. No, Ford never went soft. Ford always had a certain side to him that one might call sentimental, but not in a negative way. But this is a tough, hard – cynical movie, and you know, all the best characters are the women. All the smartest, toughest characters are the women. It's a marvelous, marvelous movie. But I think I kind of jumped the gun there. We can get back to that. But Gregory, did you have anything that you wanted to add to How Green Is My Valley?
Oh yeah. First, with Valley, I think everything's been pretty much said. I like what Joe, what you had said about how people always complain about Valley because it beat out Citizen Kane for Best Picture, so they infer that Valley is a terrible film, or maybe not a terrible film, but just not a very good one, a mediocre film. And anybody who has seen it, like numerous times, like we all have, will tell you it's one of Ford's best films, and one of the best films of 1941. I think you could maybe go, I don't know if this is a really good comparison, but it's like there's always that argument over Dances with Wolves versus Goodfellas, right? As we know, Goodfellas did not win Best Picture that year, Dances with Wolves did, but that doesn't diminish Wolves. It's actually a decent film, right? Valley is a better film than Wolves, but I think you understand my point, is that I think a lot of people just like being snarky at times with Valley, and they just dismiss it. Oh, it's sentimental. It's silly, and it's not. It's not silly at all. It's one of the most poetic films that Ford made, which is really saying something, because you know there's so much like poetry in his pictures. And Valley, almost the whole thing is poetry. And I actually revisit it more than I do with Kane, even though I do love Orson Welles, but there's actually later films of his that I like actually more, like The Trial, which I watch a lot, which I've seen quite a bit. That's one of my top films from him. Yeah. But that's very
Kane,
good.
Kane, for all its qualities, is rather cold film emotionally. And Magnificent Ambersons, my favorite film, which Welles made in 1941, 42. Truffaut said that he preferred Ambersons because he felt that in Kane, Welles was more concerned with the camera, and in Ambersons, he's more concerned with the characters. And certainly, How Green Is My Valley, Ford is a master of the camera, and the cinematography by Arthur C. Miller is just wonderful. And all the shots are just beautiful. But the characters are what you hang on to and remember, the feelings, the deep feelings about family and childhood. It's a poetic film about childhood. And also, it's a very serious film about pollution, as was Ambersons before RKO started cutting it up. It's about environmental destruction of a town, and it's about capitalism, all kinds of serious themes. So for people to dismiss it is myopic. But again, like the quality of film should really have nothing to do with Academy Awards, because as we all know, a lot of the wrong films win Academy Awards, and sometimes a good film wins, but it's not really the barometer of a good film, but unfortunately, it gets too much publicity.
Especially over the last like number of years, it's definitely not a barometer of a good picture.
Yeah,
you know, an Oscar.
Yeah.
So
most people forget Oscar winners like almost instantly. At least
yeah,
least
it's hard to remember.
I mean, you know, the thing is look, I follow the Oscars to a certain degree just for something to do. It's fun. It's part of film history. And I did the first time I did this was in 2015 or 2015, and then 2018, 2019, 2020, 2021, and 2022 for the last 5 years running, and back for 2015. So 6 out of the last 8 Oscars, I have managed to see all the Oscar nominees prior to the show. you know, so I've seen a lot. And I have to say that I think that while there's a lot of crap nominated and very often the wrong thing wins, there's also quite a bit that is pretty good. But I've come to the firm belief that a lot of the anger of, well, this should have been nominated or that should have won, could be alleviated by expanding the categories in acting and writing and directing to 6 or 7. I really do think a category expansion would help, but that's just me. But continuing along, because we do only have about 3 hours for this show, if anyone has anything to add to my selection so that we can discuss those, and then I'll go on to the next person and their selection.
What were I going to tell you again, your selections? Yeah.
It was four sons and seven women.
Seven women. Well, I guess I should say that's one of my very favorite Ford films. And it is a film maudit, you know, a damned film. And it... I did a lot of research about it, and it's an interesting thing. It was criticized by myopic American reviewers as being old-fashioned and claustrophobic because he shot it mostly on an MGM set, and it takes place in the 30s, and they said it was like a 30s melodrama, and that's just silly. And in Europe, that didn't bother people. But the reason MGM basically threw the film away was for other reasons. They had a preview in Pasadena in the summer of 65, a bad preview, although actually several people said they loved the film. They said Anne Bancroft was a swashbuckling hero like Douglas Fairbanks, and somebody wrote, give me more strong, independent female characters like her. She's a great hero, and, you know, it's a wonderful film. But there were people who attacked it, and what the audience didn't like was not that it was supposedly old-fashioned or whatever. It's that they objected to the sex and violence of the film, oddly enough. And this was the time when The Sound of Music was the most popular film in America. And the Vietnam War was going on, but people were reacting by wanting escapist saccharine entertainment. Ford made a film about missionary women stuck in China during a civil war, and it's very violent and brutal, and there is sex and violence. And that's what people were horrified by. And also, they thought Ford was attacking religion. Somebody said, you know, who's the weirdo atheist author? That was one of the quotes that somebody wrote on a card. And they didn't understand the point of the film is that the atheistic doctor, played by Anne Bancroft, is the one who behaves in the most Christian manner, ironically, paradoxically. And the missionary women fail to react in ways that are helpful in this crisis, and especially the mission leader, Margaret Leighton, is revealed as a racist and an autocrat, and she falls apart and she goes insane, and it's the atheist doctor who sacrifices herself for the other women, and so it's the opposite of an anti-religious film. He's attacking religious hypocrisy. So it was misunderstood by the audience, and I told Ford, you know, how much I liked the film when I interviewed him in 1970, and I asked him if he made it knowing the Americans wouldn't respond. He said, no, I just thought it was a swell story, and I wanted to do it, and he said it was over their heads, which is really true. It was over the heads of the audience, and over time, people have caught up with it. It's an extremely graceful film. Flora Robeson, the great British actress who's in the film, said it was like a ballet, the choreography of the blocking and The widescreen cinematography is just exquisite, and the acting is just superb all the way through. And it's such a powerful film that is apocalyptic. My friend David Ehrenstein, one of the few critics who appreciated the film at the time, wrote a piece called Ford's Apocalypse, and it's an apocalyptic vision of the breakdown of civilization, which was a theme that Ford was pursuing as he got older and became more disillusioned with politics and social structures. He thought they were collapsing, and he was rather despondent about the world. And it holds up much better and seems kind of prescient in retrospect, actually.
There were a lot of films from like later, from like veteran directors around that time that were considered old-fashioned and out of touch. And you look at them now, Seven Women is one of them. I would classify Billy Wilder's Fedora as one, Fred Zinnemann's 5 Days, 1 Summer, that they said they were creaky, melodramatic, but they play really well these days, I think, at least. You know, that they're really well structured, they're really well made films, and there's deep emotion there. Even The Last Tycoon by Elia Kazan, even though a lot of people even today still don't like that picture, I think it's very good. I think it has that sort of quality that these later works had. And even like Carl Dreyer's Gertrude, which was made in 64, that was derided by the European press to some degree as being old-fashioned and creaky. And I watch it today, and it was one of the most poignant films I think I've ever seen. So
these are examples of what's called late style, which we can appreciate. It's become more in vogue to study late style. And part of it is Stravinsky said when an artist becomes old, he no longer cares what the public thinks. You know, they just do what they want to do. And the old-fashionedness doesn't seem much of an issue when you look at these films in retrospect. They're classical films, all of them. And El Dorado by Howard Hawks is another one. And there are a number of late films by great directors. The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance by Ford, a great film, was criticized by some short-sighted reviewers for the same reason. So old masters, there's a simplicity to old artists' work that they refine their work, and they have such command of their technique that they can do, they can say a lot in a short stroke. Ford can say so much in one shot, and Seven Women is full of shots like that.
Yeah, as opposed to like many directors today who have like 80 shots and say 80 shots within like 5 minutes and say nothing.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm. Can you hear me there, guys?
Hey.
Oh yeah, I was just gonna say. I should mention that I want to restore Seven Women. I've been trying to get Warner Brothers to do this for a few years, and I had enlisted Martin Scorsese to get involved, and that's when Warner started paying attention, but then it stalled again because, you know, there are a lot of films that are restored. 6 minutes were cut out of Seven Women after that preview, and I want to put it back, and Warner's didn't even know that the film had been cut. But the fact that the film flopped, they kind of think, well, what's the point of putting out a new version? But it's the last feature film by a great American director. It's never been treated properly in America, and I wanted to have, and I'll still do this, I'm determined to do it, to have a new premiere in New York and get a press attention for it. Richard Brody of The New Yorker is a huge fan of Seven Women, for example. I'm sure it would get good press, unlike the silly press it got at the time. And but I need to – they did a search in their underground vaults, wherever they keep their vaults in Utah or wherever it is, and they found the elements to the film. And I've seen the uncut version, which played on TV syndication, and the scenes that are cut are extremely important. There's one absolutely important dramatic scene in which the mission leader, Margaret Layton, puts down Mildred Dunnock, who's her assistant, who's trying to get her own mission, and she's very cruel to her, and that's why Mildred Dunnock turns on her, and that's missing from the film. But also, when people said the film was claustrophobic and never went outside the mission set, well, Ford actually shot two elaborate scenes outdoors. One was a scene where the bandits are attacking the town, burning the town, And it was done in a very strikingly expressionistic style. And there's also a humorous scene where they go riding with Anne Bancroft, and Woody Strode is one of the bandits, and he's got a crush on Anne Bancroft, and he's giving her flowers, and Mike Mazurki, the bandit leader, covets her, and Mazurki later kills Woody Strode, which is quite shocking. And in the film, you don't quite know why he kills him, but it's because of the sexual rivalry, which is also kind of a political rivalry, and that's not fully explained in the release version. So I think the film would be better received if it were restored the scenes that were lost. So who are we calling next?
Actually, I think it's my turn for the number 10 Ford picture.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. My number 10 picture for John Ford is that one of his last, you know, we're speaking of his last pictures. It was his last film with John Wayne, Donovan's Reef. I think it's a very good film. You know, mostly a comedy, but has some really poetic lyrical scenes in it, like with all Ford. And I think it's one of Ford's funniest pictures. He did have a sense of humor. He always said he felt he was a comedy director. I remember reading that. But he said nobody would ever give him a comedy to do. But, you know, there's always comic elements, you know, like comic relief in almost all his films anyway. So, but I don't know. Donovan's Reef just has this, like, beautiful lyrical quality to it that I've always really liked. And the supporting players are always really good. I love the bar fight scene at the beginning between him and Lee Marvin. You know, just, I don't know. It's not really like a film that like gets a lot of like talk about Ford. They mainly just mention it because it was the last film he did with John Wayne. But I do like the film quite a bit. And I don't know. What do you gentlemen think about it?
Well, I think the key thing you mentioned a really important thing, and I've written an essay on this. It's in my book Two Cheers for Hollywood on Ford's comic style. I was asked to give a keynote address on Ford at the first international conference on him in Ireland, and I chose that topic because that's actually one of the most controversial topics about Ford. I wanted to pick something that not everybody agreed with, and the people who don't like Ford often tend to say his sense of humor is crude and vulgar, and you know, he likes fight scenes, which he certainly does, and he likes drunk scenes, and but they don't understand that the comedy is integral to his view of the world, and there's a very Irish perspective to seeing the world as a blend of the ridiculous and the tragic. And there's an interview Ford gave to Jean Matry, the French critic who wrote an early book on him. In 1955, right before Ford made The Searchers, he said, "I should like to do a tragedy the most serious in the world that turned into the ridiculous," which is what happens in The Searchers. I think a lot of people don't yet understand The Search becomes absurd after a while because he's a guy who's setting out supposedly to rescue his kidnapped nieces, and he winds up wanting to kill one, and he can never find them, and the sort of comic relief crazy guy played by Hank Warden is the one who keeps finding the girl, and after 5 years, he finds her right down the road from where Ethan set off on his quest, and he could have stayed home for 5 years. The whole thing is, it turns into the ridiculous because Ford is mocking the traditional hero. And so that makes his films much more complex than the detractors admit. And so when Ford said, "I'm basically a comic director," there's an Irish tendency to see the humor in things and the ridiculousness. And that's why it's also very Shakespearean that Ford, like in Shakespeare's history plays, he has scenes with the kings and the princes and serious scenes, and then he mocks them with the lower class characters.
I'm reminded of the work of the McDonough brothers, especially the not Martin, but his brother who did The Guard and Cavil.
Yeah, there's an absurdity to Banshees of Inisherin, there's a the Irish, that's people who've been oppressed for hundreds of years and colonized by the British develop a sense of mockery and humor, and Ford shares that, and that's his point of view, and you have to understand it to really understand Ford, and that's why a film like Donovan's Reef, as you say, has it's a comedy, but it has a lot of serious elements as well.
Yes.
Yeah, and also, like if I mentioned this, the whole sequence, the Dodge City sequence in Cheyenne Autumn, which I think was cut for like some print and then restored later. I think that's one of the funniest things he also ever did. I love
it.
The banter
we'll get
between
to that.
Arthur Kennedy and Jimmy Stewart. You know.
So
yeah, really, reviewers said this. What is this doing in the film? And well, he's mocking the concept of heroism in the West. He's making Wyatt Earp a humorous character, farcical. And it's all about the white people being hysterical about an Indian attack. And it turns out they all go out to fight the Indians, and only one lone hungry Indian appears on the horizon. So it is jarring in the context of this very serious film, but that's Ford meant it that way. It was a commentary on the serious drama. Often his comedy is more integrated into the drama, but in that case, it's a very stark contrast. And Seven Women is a very dark film that has a lot of humor in it as well. And you could Liberty Valance is perhaps his funniest film, and that's a very sad, very tragic film.
So, Sammy, what's your number 10?
Well, I originally kept just floating around. I kept jumping around from Man Who Shot Liberty Valance to Fort Apache to Rio Grande. And then I decided to throw all three of them out and throw in A Guilty Pleasure, Drums Along the Mohawk, 1939, which is replete with all kinds of historical inaccuracies. Yet it's an impressionist color film, beautifully photographed. I find it irresistible to watch. It's A Guilty Pleasure. It's not a great film, but certainly it was. I think it was his first color film. I'm not. Is that right, Joseph?
Yeah, that's right.
First
color film. Yeah.
And it was his first color film, and I think in that same year he made Stagecoach and Young Mr. Lincoln.
American Trilogy.
He had a hell of a year.
And he also got the grapes of wrath.
It was the weakest of the three. But that doesn't take a brain to figure that out. But it's always entertained me. It has Henry Fonda, Claudette Colbert, and it's about the Revolutionary War, which is that's a period in history I always liked, and I never thought it was given fair treatment over the years. I mean, the Patriot, Johnny Tremaine, you didn't have many great Revolutionary War films, and that era always fascinated me. And I thought I would save one of my spots for something that wasn't obviously great in a critical sense, but still is quite watchable. And I'm not trying to say it's a greater movie than The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. I'm just saying this list should have some room for some personal choices, some favorites, some guilty pleasure, and I put that one at number 10
for that
reason.
Well, now I'm actually going to go back to you, Greg, and I will ask you. You will get to start our next round. So what is your number 9?
My number 9 is Wagon Master. One of Ford's favorite of his work, if I remember right. And
yeah.
I remember him saying this, it came across what he wanted to achieve. He said it was just very pure and simple. And I do, the film is mostly like the stock characters or stock actors from his stock company, as they call it, Ben Johnson, Harry Carey Jr., Ward Bond, Jane Darwell, and Russell Simpson, et cetera, et cetera. And also, it has so much, a lot of Ford films have like dance sequences in them. It's surprising he never directed an official musical, because he had a real sense of music and of cutting during, to the music and everything and the dancing and everything. How many times do we see like square dances or like, social gatherings and dances break out in his pictures? And this one has like great like folk music, a lot, Chuck Awala Swing, I think that's the name of the tune. You know, I just love that simple, the simplicity of this picture. And I don't know, it's just another film that has that like lyrical poetic quality. Sometimes Ford films, and you know, they're almost like prayers. You almost feel like they have this reverence for them. You know, some of the best. I remember I watched The Long Gray Line recently. I hadn't seen it in a while, and it had been years since I saw it. So when I watched it again, it felt like that, you know, with like, and there was singing in that film, some beautiful like a cappella singing, which always seems to make its way into Ford pictures. So, with Wagamaster, you know, there's such a beautiful camaraderie between, you know, Ben Johnson and Harry Carey Jr. And then they see the Mormons. And I remember, I think when John Ford made She Wore Yellow Ribbon, you know, a lot of Mormons were extras because he shot that in Utah and he really liked their work ethic and he wanted to make a film about them. So I think that's where Wagamaster was born.
Yeah, Wagamaster is an interesting movie. You know, it's one of those movies that I've even heard some people say, oh, that's just another racist John Ford Western. And I'm like, oh, my
what?
God.
What?
This is
totally
this
wrong.
Is so, yeah, I know. It's, and I'm
yeah,
like, this is so wrong on so many levels.
Both. It's the opposite.
Yeah,
actually,
I put that as my favorite John Ford film currently. I mean, it sort of varies from time to time, but to me, that's my ideal film, Wagamaster. It's low budget, eight wagons, a few horses, small cast and crew. He goes out in Moab, Utah, which is kind of like the low budget version of Monument Valley, and makes this beautiful film without big stars. He cast Ben Johnson, Harry Carey Jr. In the lead role.
I love it. It may be outside of my top John Ford film, which I'll get to later. It may be the John Ford film I had the most fun watching.
Well, it is great fun, but to say, for people to say it's racist, is they haven't seen the film, I guess, because when they encounter Native Americans, the Navajos, they, at first they're afraid of being attacked, and then the Navajos turn out to be very friendly. They're you know, it's Ford's old pals from Monument Valley, and Lee Bradley is the chief guy, and he was Ford's best friend among the Navajos. He was part Irish and part Native American, and they called themselves brothers. But it's about outcasts. It's about the Mormons being discriminated against for their religion, and then the Indians are outcasts, and then they run into show people who are the other outcasts that Ford relates to them because he's a show person. You know, it's a medicine show group, and they're disreputable people, and even a couple of the Mormons think they shouldn't take up with them, but Ward Bond is the leader of the Mormons, the elder, and he says, you know, the Lord put these people in our way, and we shouldn't contradict what the Lord did. You know, it's a very witty script by Frank Nugent and Ford's son, Pat. And so it's a celebration of these outcasts who were pioneers, and it's about coexistence. But also they're being attacked by a very reptilian band of outlaws, a psychopathic family. And the two young guys who they hired to lead the wagon train have to resort to gunplay to save the Mormons. I mean, what I used to hear about the film is that it's too sentimental and nice and, you know, pacifistic. And actually, to me, the most interesting thing in reviews at the time, you know, what they didn't like about this film was the Los Angeles Times wrote, the film has very little violence and the Indians are friendly. They were disappointed that you didn't have a big Indian battle and very little gunplay. And that's what we like about the picture today. But that shows how warped and racist American film reviewing and American culture was at the time. That those were seen
it also shows that Ford, you know, had, as we've talked about already, that there were tons of nuanced performances and portrayals of everybody in his films, Native Americans included. As Adam said, people just assume that, like, oh, Wagamaster is a racist film. Have you seen it? No. It's like, well, then
yeah,
maybe
right.
You should.
Yeah,
you know,
that's so
and you would find out it is not.
Movies.
No,
it's
they don't.
And that's one thing I love about this movie is it's so fucking not racist. It's not bigoted. It's you know. I mean, if you want to call John Ford a conservative filmmaker, go ahead and do it. But his films are not largely as regressive as people think they are.
They're not even close. They're not even close. This sort of gets my dander up a bit because a lot of people don't even bother to watch the actual films. They just read something in some like film book or not even a film book, maybe just in some history book. It just says, this was that Ford was racist. And, he wasn't. He wasn't at all,
Back in the 90s, I knew a woman who was teaching film at a California university, and I was telling her about The Searchers, and she had never seen The Searchers. She didn't, it wasn't of interest to her, and it was playing at the Chinese Theater in Hollywood, and I said, I'll take you to see The Searchers, and she said, no, I don't want to see it. I mean, that's typical academia. But Wagonmaster has this beautiful scene where the Navajos and the Mormons have a square dance together. It's just a wonderful scene, and it's about harmony. And another reason the film is underrated is that it's very modest, and that's one of the virtues. The older I get, I like modest, kind of minimalist films, that are not grandiose and overdone. And Ford's research assistant, Catherine Clifton, who was a wonderful, very brilliant woman he hired, partly because she would read books with him. He would assign her books to read on the Civil War, and they would discuss them because there was nobody else in Hollywood who read books about history that he could talk to. And so she helped him a lot. She knew him well. But she said to me, he says Wagonmaster is his best film. She said, I can't believe that. This is the guy who made The Grapes of Wrath. How could he say Wagonmaster was his best film? She said, that's nothing. So even one of Ford's associates didn't quite understand why it's such a great film.
Yeah. Well, I will take my chance to say that my number 9 and my number 11 is actually Wagonmaster, so it's very close. But my number 9 is Two Road Together. It's a film that gets a lot of flack for retreading some of the on the surface some of the structure of The Searchers, but is not at all like The Searchers. People have said that, Woodmark and Stewart were mismatched. I disagree. I love the fact that, it starts off with Stewart's character taking 10% from the saloon owner. She gets tired of not getting everything she wants exactly from him, so she goes off with some other guy, and he's like, I don't really care, because in the end, I found something that I really want more than 10% of, and that's just a beautiful note to end on. It's a movie that's ultimately about two people that end up finding something that really matters, something that really matters. And it's, we always talk about camaraderie, and there is that in Ford films, but there is always the yearning for that which is truly most important and fulfilling at the core of a character's being. And it's never wealth. It's never riches in terms of money. It's always something else. It's happiness. It's peace. It's something emotional or social, and I think that's something that people don't really talk about enough in Ford's movies. They think of the westerns and this side's been vanquished and this side is victorious and that's the end, and maybe that's the end of the plot, but that's not the end of the story. But, I really, really do like this one. So
I guess I would dissent a little bit, if you don't mind. I guess that's part of what we're doing here today. We all have different tastes and different likes among Ford films, which is great. I mean, that's what makes life interesting. By the way, I'll just say, when one of us said that Ford never really made a musical, Lindsay Anderson said Wagonmaster is an avant-garde musical western. And it has so much music. The Sons of the Pioneers do kind of a choral accompaniment throughout the film.
Right.
There are dance scenes. Ford really just loved the poetic use of music in that film. But Two Road Together, I guess I've tried hard to like that film a lot. I realize Jimmy Stewart, I think, is wonderful. And some of Ford's associates said that Ford, he's very much like Ford, cantankerous, but kind of good-hearted underneath a cynical veneer. And I can see that. It's a rich performance. And it's just parts of it seem kind of slapdash and kind of crude to me. And the Woody Strode plays a kind of ridiculous character, as well as Henry Brandon, the Native American characters. But I have this feeling about Ford. He has an evil twin who directs certain films. For example, Grapes of Wrath is this beautiful tribute to poor migrant people, and then he follows it up with Tobacco Road, where he's making fun of same kind of people. It's a horrible film, but visually very beautiful.
I saw Tobacco Road recently, and I would not want to revisit it. It just seemed very slight.
It's embarrassing.
It's very crude, but you know, it's Ford's evil twin kind of having a field day. And the same thing I think with Two Road Together is it's sort of like a more ridiculous version of The Searchers, and in a sense it goes along with what I was saying about Ford could see the ridiculous side of life. And in that film, it's kind of a despondent view of trying to rescue white settlers from the Indians that you know, these poor settlers are trying to get people back, and Jimmy Stewart is extremely cynical about it. And it's kind of
it's a much more hard-boiled film. It's a much more hard-boiled film than, like, I think, than The Searchers is. It's very almost film noirish. It's got a very, like you said, cynical undertone to it. But you know, in some ways, I do like that picture quite a bit, and I like that cynical tone to it. You know, it's a much more real. Again, maybe not realistic. It's realistic, but I don't know. It's much better. It usually gets slighted a lot by people. I don't think it's, I wouldn't put it in my top 10, but I do think it's underappreciated. There was that period between, right after The Searchers and before Liberty Valance, where a lot of Ford's films generally aren't, like, respected as much as, like, others, but he still managed to make some excellent pictures in that time. Two Road Together was one, Sergeant Rutledge is another. If I remember right, Joe, you just did a commentary on The Horse Soldiers, right, with Eureka Blu-ray?
Yeah.
And that's got very good moments in it as well. So,
yeah, I think, Two Road Together, he said, was the worst piece of crap I made in 20 years, is the way he put it. And I think, for example, What Price Glory is really a pretty awful film. But I saw that again recently, and I kind of watched it for its kind of anarchic, nihilistic qualities. Ford was... he had sort of contempt for the whole project, and that kind of came across. So there's kind of a manic, crazy energy to it, but it's kind of disconcerting. He would make, Ford made a lot of sort of so-so films, not very good films. There's usually some really good sequence in the midst of every Ford film, no matter how awful it is. But he didn't feel very engaged by the material of Two Road Together, but he kept working. He wanted to keep working. He was having trouble in later years getting as many projects off the ground as he wanted. But I do think that hard edge quality that you mentioned is really true. And you know, the treatment, for example, the pathetic white woman whose son has gone totally over to the Indian way of life and kills her, that's a really shocking sequence. And then they lynch.
Oh yeah.
The kid, that's really powerful stuff. I mean, it's really appalling. And then there's a terrific scene
I was really sitting there going, oh, shit, Ford went there and showed that. Because, you know, people, and I think this is another scene where people probably sit there and think this is Ford going, isn't this a shame for that to happen to a good white boy? And I'm sitting there thinking, wow, he has the balls to show that anyone would be ignorant enough to think that, you know, he's pointing out, pointing out the everything else. And I mean, Ford may be the most misunderstood and assumed about great director of all time.
Yeah, and, you know, besides that sequence, there's so much going on that's really shocking. There's a wonderful sequence where Linda Crystal, who is Latina, who has been living with the Indians, and they bring her back, a very dignified, beautiful woman, and she's taken to a dance in a cavalry fort by Jimmy Stewart, and they all snub her. Ford is very scathing toward the white society. And there's a powerful speech where Stewart just berates them for their racism. That's terrific stuff, you know. But it's some of the even though I defend Ford's use of comedy, some of the low comedy in that film is really awful, where people are hitting each other over the head with flour barrels or whatever they're doing. And Andy Devine is butting people into the water with his big stomach, and it's very buffoonish, but, you know, it's kind of, that's what happens.
Yeah, some of the humor doesn't work, but everything else about it is, you know.
Yeah.
I thought it was pretty good. But, so, Sammy, what is your number 9?
Although the New York film critics in 1935 gave the film their best picture, and they gave John Ford best director. Oddly, over the years, it doesn't get the respect that I'm referring, of course, to The Informer. Everybody figured that out already, but it hasn't gotten the respect I think that it deserves to have gotten. And there are certainly some cineasts, some critics who think it was heavy-handed, and they didn't even buy into McLaglen's performance, which won Best Actor that year from both the film critics and the Academy Awards. So everybody was on board that year. It never mentions the IRA, I don't think, like Carol Reed's Odd Man Out. Never really mentions IRA, but it's clear what's going on there. It's a gripping, expressionistic Billy August photography. Max Steiner's Oscar-winning score, which is actually one of his best, in my opinion. And it's a riveting movie of betrayal, and all the religious symbolism is very, very effective. As I say, there are some who say it's heavy-handed. I know, and when you look at this canon, you know, there are people who won't put that film among the top Ford films, for various reasons, but How Green Was My Valley and The Grapes of Wrath, his departure from his normal type of film, when he left the Western genre and did these standalone films, in my opinion, they were all, you know, mega masterpieces. That one, as well as The Grapes of Wrath and How Green Was My Valley, it contains one of the great, I forget the name of the actor who plays Frankie, the Irish guy that he turns in. I don't remember his name.
Frank McHugh.
He was very effective. And you know, it keeps you mesmerized. You know, where is he going to spend the money? And then they're watching him, and then, you know, you're adding up. He's, you know, 2 pence there, a couple 2 pounds there, and just shows you, you know, he's not an evil man. You know, he looks at the posters, he wants to go to America, but he still pulls off, you know, unconscionable betrayal. You know, one of his closest friends turns him in, and then they kill him. And, you know, the craftsmanship right across the board was top rank, in my opinion, again. I would like to even put it higher than number 9, but some of the movies that you have gotten talked about before, like Wagon Dance and some others, are higher. But I still feel it deserves to be in any top 10 of John Ford's greatest films.
Yep. And I think this is a place to point out, in case the audience wonders, of course, you know, if there's any time where, like, we've already talked about Wagon Master, so when Joe comes to his number one, which he's already said is Wagon Master, yeah. We won't end up, you know, discussing the same movie, say, three or four times. We'll just discuss it whenever the first person brings it up and then mention, and this is where I slotted it in for myself, and then keep moving. So Joe, what is your number nine?
Number nine, a film that a lot of people don't know, but a really great film, Pilgrimage, 1933,
oh, God.
Which I think is Ford's first great film. And I'll give you some background. My friend David Shepard, the late David Shepard, he was a guy who discovered and saved a lot of American films for the American Film Institute and the Library of Congress, and he distributed films. And he told me back in the late 60s when I was getting interested in Ford and starting to write about him, he said, you know, I just saw Ford's masterpiece, Pilgrimage, and I had never even heard of it. And I said, what is this? And he said, it's this film we just rediscovered that he made for Fox in 1933. And I saw it. It is an amazing, great film, and it's very anomalous for Ford because it's about a mother who kills her son, basically, and it's the closest analogy in Ford's work is Ethan Edwards in The Searchers is trying to kill his niece. It's the worst possible thing in Ford because he values the home and family above everything else. But to try to kill your loved one is crazy. And Henrietta Crosby.
It's a marvelous movie.
Yeah.
Henrietta
Crosby gives a great performance. She's a stage actress primarily, who made very few films, but she's just wonderful in this picture. It did well at the box office, and then it was ignored. Partly because it fell under the category of a women's picture, which seven women met the same fate. Critics, reviewers in those days, this is the 30s and even the 60s, were scorning women's pictures. I'm sorry?
I was picking on Bosley Crowther.
Well, he actually kind of liked Ford more than other people, but... seven women was scorned because it's about women. But, you know, and even some film buffs would say this for a long time, you know, and then they started calling them chick flicks. There's a bias even today against movies about women. But, of course, there's a whole rediscovery of films about women or by women directors, by women writers, producers, et cetera. A lot of times people forget that women wrote and produced a lot of films, even though there were few women directors in Hollywood. But now we see it in a much different light. A lot of these women's pictures, as they call them, dealt with social issues in a much more powerful way than so-called male action pictures or whatever. Douglas.
I'm glad somebody put this movie in their top 10 because I was sorely tempted to put it in my top 10. It's not in my top 10, but I want it to be. It's just outside. It's in that knocking at the door. It's that bunched up 11 through 15. Area where any of them could be, say, my 7 to 10. And after all, we are talking about John Ford, so you know he's very, you know, his there's a lot of truly great movies, but this thing took me totally by surprise. I had heard about it only in passing. I'd seen it. I saw that it got some, you know, decent reviews, did some good box office. But I had never seen it until last year when I did the run-up. I saw it like maybe a day or two before the show. I finally got my copy. I was really worried that I wasn't going to get that copy and I was going to not actually end up not being able to see everything Ford did before, you know, either revisit or first watches. And there were many first watches. This was one of the very, very few. And I will have to say I think it is Ford's best film prior to How Green Is My Valley.
Well,
I hold it in that high regard. I think it is phenomenal.
Glad you agree. When we did the Ford at Fox box set some years ago with 20th Century Fox, put out a 24-film set, very wonderful set, and I did audio commentaries on some of the films, but one that I said you got to include, Pilgrimage, and they weren't going to include it, but I offered to do the commentary, and so I got them to reissue that film, and then they put it out on a separate DVD with a very bad film called Born Reckless, one of Ford's worst films, odd combination. But Pilgrimage is, when I said it's a woman who kills her son, some people might wonder, what? It's a woman who is a religious fanatic in Arkansas, in a backwoods woman. It's very stylized.
Arkansas?
Like
I seem to remember it being Virginia, but maybe I'm wrong.
No,
maybe
it's Three Cedars, Arkansas is what it's called.
Okay,
it's filmed on studio sets like a Murnau film, very influenced by Murnau and Four Sons.
Oh, yeah.
And Murnau's Sunrise, which Ford thought was the best film ever made. But anyway, Crossman, her son, he's sneaking off to have sex. This is a pre-code film. Sneaking off to have sex with a young woman who is kind of even lower on the social totem pole with them. So she despises the young woman, but she's also a fanatically possessive mother, and she doesn't want her son to have any kind of woman that he loves, and she treats him like a serf on the farm, and he wants to escape. And anyway, World War One comes along, and he wants to enlist, and she refuses. And then when he says, "I'm going to leave you and marry this woman," she enlists him in the army to get rid of him. And she knows that he's going to die. It's quite clear in the film that she's sending him to his death rather than, she actually says late in the film, "I killed him, and I'd rather have him dead than married to you," she tells the young woman. It's shocking, but you know, very true, dark film about human nature. And then what's even more amazing, and this goes along with what I said about Ford using comedy and tragedy in the same film, it rather surprised me when I first saw it that the first half is a stark tragedy. It's really a Greek tragedy, kind of. And then it turns into a comedy when she goes to Europe on a pilgrimage with a lot of other Gold Star mothers who lost sons in the war, who were very sympathetic figures, and she's this hard-bitten old woman, very mean old lady, and she goes to France, and she's changed by the experience, and she finds a drunken young American boy who's thinking of killing himself, and kind of saves his life, and I've had a running argument with another Ford scholar for years, Janet Bergstrom. I say Pilgrimage is about redemption. In Ford's Catholic view of the world, you can redeem yourself from sin. And Janet says what the woman does is unforgivable, and I can see her point of view that killing your son, how can you ever forgive that? But Ford feels that the woman can be redeemed, and that's what the film is about. And it's the comic parts are underscore the serious parts, and then it turns you know, very dramatic again toward the end. And it's just a really amazing film that people would not expect from John Ford, I think.
Yeah, no, it's a marvelous movie. So now we get to, Sammy, I don't think you've ever seen Pilgrimage, have you?
I have not seen the film. I listened. It was a fascinating discussion. I'm sorry I haven't seen it.
You need to see it. It is available.
I know.
Get a
I'm
copy of it.
To it.
Yeah, I've not seen it either.
I know that Fern Smith Neame had curated it as part of her young or early Ford set last year on Criterion Channel, but as far as I know, Criterion did not keep Pilgrimage. They kept some other stuff from that curation, but they did not keep that film, which is a damn shame. But yeah, Sammy, you get to kick off round three. So
number eight.
What is your number eight?
Number eight. It's always difficult to pick one of the three Calvary films. If you're going to just pick one for your list, and I know some lists will have two or even three, and legitimately so, but which one do you pick? I jump from one to the other. You know, I love all three of them. And I'm guessing that the slight majority of people would lean towards the first one, Ford Apache. That's just my guess, but because of Winton C. Hawk's color cinematography, And because it's funny, the dialogue is funny. There's so many funny lines in it. And I think John Wayne said something like, why did they nominate me for Sands of Iwo Jima? I should have been nominated, but she wore a yellow ribbon. He was angry or something, and supposedly Ford said to him that this film proves that you're an actor. You know, you're officially a great actor after that film. Of course, there were other great performances, and the whole idea of the film, it was just irresistible narrative following along with it. You know, out of the three films, I would say I could watch that one, you know, more often than the other ones. I have that at number 8, but that there are no other cavalry films ahead of it. Looking at my top 10, so that's in the highest position. But I'll let an expert like Joseph and also now I'm forgetting his name.
Greg.
Man's name. Yeah, right. To say something. But, they want to add to that or just jump to their own choice. I don't know how you're going to do it.
I
would agree that John Wayne should have won an Oscar for She Wore a Yellow Ribbon. And that's the film. Howard Hawks told me that after Ford saw Red River, in which Wayne plays an older man and a very kind of nasty fellow, complex fellow, Ford said, "I never knew the big son of a bitch could act." And he put him in She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, playing a man of about 60, when he was in his 30s, and he's terrific in the film. Great performance. I did a list. I think Wayne should have won about 6 Oscars if you're, you know, honest. Searchers should have won an Oscar. Liberty Valance should have won an Oscar. Quiet Man, perhaps. Sands of Iwo Jima is terrific, you know. But my favorite cavalry film, I'll get to it in due course, I guess, is Fort Apache. I think that's the film that turned me on to Ford, and I think it's a really great film. She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, I think the script is not quite as powerful as Fort Apache, but the color, as you mentioned, Winton C. Hoke was a great color cameraman.
Yeah, we're basically in agreement. I think that She Wore a Yellow Ribbon has the better performance, but Fort Apache is the better film. So actually, this brings us to you, Joe. What is your number 8?
Well, this would be surprising because this used to be my number 1, but with Ford, you know, part of it is he made 136 films, so it's kind of hard to choose among them. I believe there are 90
in existence. 75 are still around.
Well, there are about 90 in existence. I've now seen all the ones that exist that he directed. It took me forever. I finally saw his film about Taiwan, his training film. It took me forever. But, you know, I've gotten kind of OD'd on certain films. I used to. The Searchers used to be my favorite, and I kind of wore that out from seeing it too much. And then The Quiet Man, the same thing happened. So Searchers, I put number 8. Now, you know, on a given day, you might put this number 1. But, you know, it fluctuates. But, you know, it's just kind of over the years. I think The Searchers has some flaws. But, you know, a great film can have flaws. A great work of art can have flaws and contradictions. One time, Jonathan Lethem and I, he's a well-known novelist friend of mine who loves The Searchers, and I called him and I said, let's talk about this film in depth when I'm writing my biography. I wanted to tap into his mind. And we spoke for 3 hours, and we concluded the film is basically incoherent, but the incoherence is powerful, expressive in itself. You know, race is the most difficult theme in American history to deal with, and we still have, you know, we're still struggling with it in our country, obviously. And Ford was very brave in making this film about a racist character.
It is much higher on my own list, but you know, I know that I was in a film class. No, not a film class, but it was a films as literature class, and the topic of The Searchers came up, and one person, and not a younger person, but an older person, said that they didn't think that that film should even be discussed because of its treatment of race, and in particular the unfortunate comedy involving the Native wife. But you know, it's so much more than that sequence. And it is a film that deals in nuance and complexities. And, you know, it asks you to watch Ethan. But I never felt like the film was really asking you to condone Ethan.
No, no, far from it, really. I think it asks you to understand him, and that's the challenge of art. Art doesn't solve questions. It raises questions. It makes you understand people.
And understanding
people,
doesn't mean agreeing with them. I mean, you know, you can understand why, say, Hitler did what he did, but that doesn't mean that you are saying, oh, I understand that it was okay. No, it wasn't, but you may know the reasons why, you know, a lack of mystery is not the same thing as approval.
Yeah, and it's part of what's wrong with American films in the modern day is they want characters to be likable, which is a very naive concept, because a lot of the most interesting characters, even in American film history, are not terribly likable people. They're complex people with a lot of flaws. But today, they tend to want to sandpaper down the flaws in characters so that they're
not going to
offend some group, whether it's in the U.S. or China or wherever, you know. And so they produce a lot
I've
of bland
of,
characters.
Goodfellas was it had no likable characters.
Well, I mean, Scorsese specializes in characters that are hard to like. But, you know, Brecht had this theory, and Straub, Jean-Marie Straub, the filmmaker, said that Ford was the most Brechtian of filmmakers because he does things that make you think. And Brecht had this alienation effect theory that he didn't want you to have a facile emotional identification with a character, which he said interfered with your thinking process. He wanted you to he put in things that alienated you from the characters, and Ford does this too, in order to make you think about the characters. And Ethan is a great example and a really great performance. Jimmy Stewart told me, he said he thought that was one of the greatest performances of all time. And you somewhat understand Ethan, and he's somewhat mysterious, but that's good too in a film. And visually, it's one of the most stunning films. One problem I have with it today, it's unfortunate, as you get older, films age with you, and The Searchers is no longer the same film it was when I first saw it back in the 60s. It's deteriorated. The prints have deteriorated. The negative is deteriorated. The three-strip Technicolor, the whole yellow layer has collapsed. So when they make prints, they have to introduce some yellow into it, and some of the home video versions look awful. The skies look green, etc. And it just isn't the same film. It was so beautiful to see it on the big screen. I used to see an original Technicolor print out of Chicago. First I saw it in Chicago, and then we brought it to Madison a number of times when I was in school there, and Mike Willington and I were writing our book. And it's so stunning, the cinematography. It's great, almost three-dimensional. And we wrote a piece, the most influential piece I wrote about films was the one Wellington and I did on The Searchers, which appeared in Sight and Sound in 1971. And the film had been kind of forgotten. It got good reviews in America at the time, but it was kind of forgotten except for Peter Wallin and Andrew Saris had written about it. But we wrote this piece in Sight and Sound, and suddenly the film appeared on the Sight and Sound top 10 list of international critics in 1972. Actually, it was number 19. It was the first time it appeared on the top 100. And then a few years, the next list, 10 years later, I think it was number 7 or number 8 or something like that. And the film suddenly became accepted as a great classic. It's kind of self-evident when you see the film. It says so much about America. It's really, as we said in our article, it's the story of American life. You know, it's about the destruction of Native American life, and it's about white racism, and it's about The hero gradually becomes Jeffrey Hunter, who's a mixed race man. He's a modern man, and it's about Ford is examining what's wrong with the American psyche and how we can try to heal ourselves to some extent. And Ethan is left unhealable. He's left wandering forever between the winds. In the famous ending shot, he goes out into the desert. He's not capable of being civilized, living in civilized society.
He can't go back in and join the family.
No, it's really, really a powerful, sad, tragic film, a great film.
Yeah, no. You know, and believe it or not, and I hadn't read your article at the time when I wrote about it for my class, but I brought up some of the same issues. So, you know, I actually feel pretty proud. I will just admit I feel pretty proud that I hit on some of that. So, no, it's a rich film. It's my second favorite Western of all time after The Wild Bunch. But it's my number three Ford film. I'll just say it. It's my number three Ford. I can't say it any better than what you just did.
It's interesting you say your favorite Western is not a Ford Western. I scandalize people sometimes by saying my favorite Western is Shane, which is not a Ford film. It's a George Stevens film. Shane is the consummate Western. It is the most classical Western in form and content. It summarizes the kind of basic themes and tropes of the Western in a perfect way, and it's very beautiful and very moving and complex. And also, I think it influenced The Searchers because it's about a loner, kind of a violent man who comes. He wants to settle down, and he can't settle down, and the housewife falls in love with Shane, and it's very, very beautiful film. I think Stevens is the most underrated American director, but Ford is the master of the Western genre. He made 54 Westerns. He said to me when I asked him about Westerns, he said, "I haven't made that many Westerns." And I said, "You know, 54 Westerns, who else will make that many Westerns in a lifetime?"
Well, you know, now for me, my number eight, it's Sergeant Rutledge. I'll just leave it there. I'll let you guys discuss it. Sammy, you haven't chimed in a while, so.
Yeah, Sergeant Rutledge is like my number seven. So
yeah,
I just had watched it. TCM had shown it, and it was on my DVR, so I watched it again in a really, really good print from TCM as well, and it's really a brilliant movie, and it goes back to.
Yeah, I mean, Woody Stroh's amazing in there.
Yeah, he is, and it goes back to, and Jeffrey Hunter is great in there too. It just goes back to what we said before about how people always say Ford is racist, and I'm like, have you actually seen Sergeant Rutledge? And they probably never even heard of that one. And you know, it's an incredibly powerful film. Strode is great, Hunter is excellent. Even Carlton Young, who plays the nasty prosecutor, who also says the great line in Liberty Valance about print the legend. You know, was in like a lot of later Ford films. I think he's in the Horse Soldiers as well, and Cheyenne Autumn, and he's wonderful in the picture. So, I think it is one of Ford's best films.
So
is
Juano Hernandez, one of the great unsung American actors, Puerto Rican descent, great, really great actor, who plays a very powerful character of an aging cavalryman, a black cavalryman. He's just great. What a great actor.
Yeah, Juan Hernandez. He was in that Intruder in the Dust. That's him, right?
Yeah, Intruder in the Dust. He had an amazing part, and he's in The Breaking Point and The Pawnbroker, a lot of films. But I'll mention a scene in Sergeant Rutledge, which is one of the most, I'd say it's the most radical and most challenging scene in all of Ford, is the scene in which when Rutledge is, he's been under restraint because he's been arrested for a crime he didn't commit, but they've let him free because the Indians are attacking, but one of the other troopers gets killed by the Indians, and he falls in Monument Valley, and Strode goes out and tries to save him and comfort him as he's dying, and the man is named Trooper Moffat, and he says, what's going to happen to my three little girls? And Woody Strode says they're going to be awful proud of you. But he says we're fools to fight the white man's war, is what Moffat tells him as he's dying. He says we're fools to fight the white man's war. And Woody Strode says it ain't the white man's war. We're fighting to make us proud, your three little girls. And you know, so it's this despairing comment about the United States and racism from this black trooper as he's dying, and it's so powerful. It challenges everything about race in America and everything about Ford, and then Ford balances it with Woody Strode, who's the character who believes in racial progress and ultimate integration, and the military is the traditional way that minorities are able to be accepted and rise in American society, whether it's Irish or blacks or other groups. But I went to the Academy Library to find out who played Moffat, because he's not credited. It's an actor named Naaman Brown, who's in very few films. He's just great in that sequence. And I showed that to my class recently, and they were just kind of knocked out. But the 1960 American film would have a scene like that. You know, it's as radical as anything.
Yeah, there's a lot of naivete about, you know, they think anything made before, I think, 1980 or is this so, old fashioned and creaky, and that's not actually true.
I'll be honest, I used to have that attitude myself
about old Hollywood pictures, which I am, to my ever deep shame, which has obviously been rectified. And the first really old school Hollywood director I got into was actually John Ford. And They Were Expendable was the first film of his that I was like, wow, these old directors are actually really good. You know, and then I watched all the Ford films I could watch, and then I went to Billy Wilder, and then I went to Charlie Chaplin, Frank Capra, Preston Sturges, et cetera, et cetera. And I was just, and I've kind of just still been in that old Hollywood mode, and I don't see a lot of newer films, because I just don't think the few I do see, I just don't think are very good compared to the old.
And before we move on with this, I do want to say that I've always thought that Rutledge and Rashomon have a little in common in terms of you know, the structure in terms of the central, what actually happened, and the way that it can be interpreted, even though we know that there is actually an objective truth here, whereas in Rashomon there really isn't. But this is an endlessly fascinating film that, it's one of those later Ford films that doesn't deserve the scorn, the ignominy, and the lack of attention that it gets.
These people who scorn Ford and all, I think, are kind of pathetic characters, aren't they? I mean, you know, they basically just haven't seen the work, and they kind of automatically reject it. And I think I don't know how much influence they have anymore. I mean, it is true that when they do top 10 lists and everything, Ford films don't get as much attention as they deserve. But that's also true of Lubitsch and Hawks and other great directors.
Wilder. You might see The Apartment, Sunset Boulevard, Some Like It Hot, but you're not going to see any of his other movies. Once in a blue moon, you'll see someone list Double Indemnity, and they're like, ooh. But Greg, I know you
they
just went,
list,
but...
a lot of Wilder films, 1, 2, 3 is another one that should be...
Wilder's kind of on the rise in this recent Sight and Sound poll. He's got more films on there than Lubitsch, and somebody was decrying that. But I think people are seeing Wilder. I wrote a book on him that he was for a long time seen as just a cynic, and people dismissed him for that reason. And I think he was a disappointed romantic, and they're starting to realize he too is much more complex than they realize, but
he is.
His romantic period was his last period in the '70s. Those films are very melancholy and wistful. Avanti and Fedora in particular. Fedora was another film that I alluded to earlier about how later films of directors that got dismissed, and now we look at them and we're like, these weren't so bad. I really like Fedora. I know some people think it's a little melodramatic.
No, Fedora's a
I don't
a
think
lovely
it is.
Little...
It is melodrama. So what's wrong with melodrama?
Well, they designed it that way. It's a tribute to and a critique of the old Hollywood kind of filmmaking. And the film that I like most of the late Wilder is Avanti. I put it on my top 10 list for the Sight and Sound poll. And That's a film that was totally scorned and dismissed for being too romantic in the 70s, when being romantic was a dirty word. So taste change and people, you know, these silly moods of the public come and go, and then, you know, it's standing the test of time is what matters.
I think the public is yearning for deeply romantic films again. They haven't had any in, like, a long time. That Like, we're talking about, like, you know, the deeper romances, like, from, like, the classic era. And then, you know, in the 70s and the 80s, that was all kind of mocked. In the 90s, became all, like that cynical, smug, like, 90s kind of attitude towards things. Try being romantic in that decade. That was almost impossible. Anyway, go ahead.
Finally, it's your turn, Greg, and you know, we already know you're 7, but what is your 8?
8 is one I'm surprised nobody's mentioned yet. It's The Quiet Man. Number 8's a lovely, wonderful film that I saw. I haven't traveled much abroad, but I did go to Ireland many years ago for my honeymoon, and my wife is half Irish, and I'm part Irish as well, so that was nice, and we actually visited Spittal, where John Ford was born. And so Ireland obviously has changed a bit since 1952 when that film was made. But that film is really just, you know, it has that wonderful opening scene where, you know, Wayne goes into the pub and he's just like, I just bought the place back. And, you know, Francis Ford, he introduces himself to everybody, and then they all break out in that beautiful song. I actually think it's Dan Curtis who sings the song, who, you know, sang a lot, had a beautiful voice, and sang quite a bit in Ford pictures. So,
well,
and then I do
this,
like the brawl. I love the brawl at the end of the film. I think it's funny.
Oh, the brawl is the best part. I remember seeing this movie as a kid, and what had happened is my mother had recorded it because she saw that it was coming on. I was maybe, oh, Jesus, I don't know, I was probably about 9 or 10, and it had come on, and they weren't going to cut it because they were showing it. They were showing it with commercials, but not cut. So it, like, took up the better part of an old VHS tape to get it. And I remember sitting there as a kid thinking, this is one of the greatest sequences I've ever seen in my life. You know, they stop to have a beer. They, you know, talk to each other a moment. They decide, no, they're not done. They're going to go back to beating each other up. It's marvelous. I think it's John Wayne's best performance. I think it's got top three or four cinematography in Ford's filmography. It's my number one.
We don't have enough barroom brawls in movies these days.
It's sad. The last I played a video game, God of War Ragnarok, in which there was a barroom brawl, and I couldn't help but think, damn, I think John Ford would have loved that shit.
Yeah, the only other director that really does barroom brawls is Clint Eastwood. There's actually brawls in, like, several of his films. Bronco Billy, Every Which Way But Loose. I think there's one in The Rookie, which is not a particularly good film, but it's there anyway. But the one in Bronco Billy, the whole film, Every Which Way But Loose, is kind of a barroom brawl in many ways. So there's another thing that, like, you know, we need to bring back to films.
I said, this is my number one Ford, so I'm glad it got brought up before me.
I'll chime in on The Quiet Man, which used to be my number one, and I kind of wore it out seeing it so often, but it's a wonderful film. It's a perfect Ford film, and it's one of his rare films with a genuine, happy resolution. It's a joyous Shakespearean kind of resolution. It's a very misunderstood film because, you know, the fight scene is misunderstood. That what people don't realize is that Mary Kate, the Maureen O'Hara character, engineers the entire fight scene because she wants her husband to fight for her to prove his love for her in the eyes of the community. And he's seen as a coward, although he's a troubled boxer who's killed a man in the ring and doesn't want to fight again. And it's a very complex character, and it's kind of about Ford exercising the demon of battle, is the way I put it. And He made it after he made a whole string of war films after he came back from the war, and he's a pacifist boxer. And the fight is a joke. It's not a serious fight. He's fighting this older guy, Victor McLaughlin, who's used to be a great fighter, but he's old and clumsy, and it's a rollicking frolic. But it's also related to there's an Irish tradition from long before called dragging home the bride, which you were supposed to do. You get your bride from another tribe and drag her home, and that's what they're enacting in the film. And people don't realize that. Americans don't understand these traditions, and they don't understand the dowry too, why it's important to her. I've heard Ford fans mock Mary Kate for wanting her dowry, her money, and John Wayne's character as an American says that dirty money, who cares about the money? Well, it's her independence. It's her property. It's her own. It makes her an independent woman, and they just don't understand that. And that so, also when he's dragging her through the fields, he's not really hurting her. It's just she's choreographed the whole thing, and literally, Marina O'Hara and John Wayne choreographed that together. And she set it up as a kind of a play acting thing. And it's really about two people who are both very strong and feisty characters who want what they want, and they're having to work out a relationship. It's Ford's most mature and complex love story. He himself said, I haven't done a lot of love stories. And Rio Grande, though, he did a good love story with Wayne and O'Hara right before that. That was the price that Republic exacted from him to make The Quiet Man, which they thought would be a flop. It's interesting that Quiet Man was a big hit, and it won the Academy Award for Best Director and Best Cinematography, et cetera. But the studios, everybody rejected that film. They thought it would be some kind of art film. But I think part of the reason they rejected it was it had political overtones that were gradually stripped down. There are some political overtones in the film about the IRA, but it was more about that.
Scene when they're in the pub and Barry Fitzgerald like salutes one of the other Irishmen, and he goes, "Yeah, oh, this is loot. We're at peacetime, man." And then Barry Fitzgerald goes, "Well, I haven't given up hope."
one of the best lines.
A wonderfully dark Irish joke.
Yeah, exactly.
It was Anthony Burgess who said as he got older, he got more Irish. And I don't really – and he just said that he would speak his mind more and he wouldn't, like, hold things back. And, you know, I don't know. I'm part Irish myself, and many of us are. And and then that's probably where I get our dark sense of humor. You know, it helps us through life. We've been oppressed for so many centuries, you know. So we have to have a sense of humor about it.
Yeah, and there's also kind of a prejudice against the Irish that still is acceptable in some circles. I've written a piece on Ford's Irishness that certain writers about Ford, such as James Agee, I've never liked James Agee because of his review of Ford Apache, in which he said he actually wrote in 1948, there's enough Irish humor to make me wish Cromwell had done a better job. Can you imagine that? Cromwell to the Irish is like Hitler was to the Jews. He committed genocide in Ireland. But this is 1948, 3 years after the world all learned about the Nazi genocide. And for somebody in the Nation to make that kind of comment is shocking. And I've seen that repeated by an academic. And you read that sometimes. People talk about Irish people in Ford films with stereotypes of drinking and fighting. And there is some of that, obviously, in Ford films, but there's a lot more going on than that. And Ford's Irishness is so integral to his work. And one reason I love Ford is that most Americans in his time believed in the melting pot. And I was taught that as a kid, that we should all lose our ethnic characteristics and become homogenized Americans. And it fostered shame about our roots. And it wasn't until Alex Haley wrote Roots in the early 70s that you were thinking you should be proud of your roots. But Ford was proud of his roots long before that, and he was unabashed about proclaiming he was an Irishman and celebrating the Irish. But not only that, he celebrates other ethnic groups in his films. And he's one of the few American directors of his period who always had black people in his films and other ethnic groups. Latinos and German Americans, French Canadians, all kinds of Mexicans,
yeah,
all kinds of
like
people.
Latino, like in the Three Godfathers, you know, Pedro. I can never pronounce.
Armendariz.
Pronounce
yeah.
his last. Yeah, he's second billed along with John Wayne, and he's also second billed in the Fugitive as well. You know.
Yeah, which is a 1947
and 1948.
He was the biggest American. He was the leading Mexican male star at the time, and that's one reason Ford put him in his films. But he loved Armendariz, a wonderful actor, and he's great in Ford Apache. Charles Ramirez Berg wrote a good piece on Latinos in Ford films, and he said that Armendariz' character in Ford Apache is the first fully rounded Hispanic character in an American Hollywood film, in a Hollywood film, not American film, but Hollywood film. And so Ford always dealt with people's ethnicity, and so there's some stereotyping in his work, but he's more promoting a kind of fellow feeling and warmth between different groups, and he's always involving them because he sees America as a polyglot country, like John F. Kennedy called us a nation of immigrants, and Ford, that's how Ford saw it. It was part of the fabric of America, and today that's controversial again because of all the xenophobia and they're going on. And so Ford, I value Ford for that. Unlike Hawks, for example, was very WASPy filmmaker, had very few ethnic characters in his films. And Capra always stereotyped black people in his films, almost always. But Ford was much richer in his treatment of race than almost any director from his time.
So now I'm going to take a short diversion here. We're coming up in about 15 minutes or so to where we'll go into what I call overtime. We have about 15 more minutes of live radio and about an hour and 15 minutes before we'll have to wrap this up. So we'll probably have to start running this long a little bit, unfortunately. Before I do that, before we go into that, so anybody that is listening, please know that we will seem to get cut off, but the rest of the show, the next hour or so, will be available about an hour and a quarter, hour and a half after we go off air, because it takes about 15 to 30 minutes for the rest of the audio to process. And I also need to take this time quickly to announce what's coming up on Cathode Ray Mission. Cathode Ray Mission will be back in 2 weeks on March 17th with a look at the career of George Lucas. 2 weeks after that, we will be back with a look at the Young Indiana Jones series. Originally called the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles. It was rebranded on DVD as The Adventures of Young Indiana Jones. For good or for ill, we will discuss all of that over the next two episodes. So I now return us to John Ford, and I go to you, Joe. So real briefly, what is your number seven?
Do you think we should, in light of the fact that some people are going to be not listening after 15 minutes, we should just tell what the rest of our films are on the list, and then we can go through them?
You know, I definitely prefer it this way. This just lets it be more conversational, I think.
Yeah, okay, well, we'll go through. Above Quiet Man, which is my number seven, is Sunshine's Bright, number six, which it was Ford's favorite film of all his work. Sometimes he said Wagon Master, sometimes How Green Was My Valley. Whatever mood he was in, differed. But The Sunshine's Bright, he kept saying over and over again, was his favorite. And that film is a terribly misunderstood film. I did the commentary for that on the British Blu-ray Masters of Cinema. It's a great film about race, very, very complex, very moving film taking place in the early turn of the century, Kentucky, a racist community, and a judge who's an enlightened man who is, you know, leading his town into a more enlightened view of race, and the much maligned comedian Stephen Fetchett, who I think is a marvelous actor comedian, who I interviewed, and I think he's terribly misunderstood character. Ford loved him and used him in wonderful roles, and he told me that Ford made The Sunshine's Bride because in Judge Priest, which Stephen Fetchett had done with Will Rogers and Ford in 1934, there's a scene in which Rogers saved Stephen Fetchett from a lynching, and Fox cut it out because there was a taboo in American films back then. You couldn't show a black man being lynched or being rescued. And so Ford always resented that, and he wanted to do it again. And so finally in 1953, he was able to do it for Republic on the strength of The Quiet Man being a big hit. They let him do his little pet project. And but the mood had changed. There weren't as many lynchings going on. You know, we tend to forget Americans lynch people, you know, periodically. A lot of lynchings went on every year in America. But even after Sunshine's Bride, Emmett Till was lynched in 55, and it wasn't until actually last year, 2022, that they finally passed an anti-lynching bill in Congress, the Emmett Till anti-lynching bill. Back in the 30s and 40s, even Roosevelt wouldn't support anti-lynching bills because he needed Southern votes to get the New Deal passed. But Ford put an anti-lynching scene in Young Mr. Lincoln, but he had Lincoln rescuing two white clients. You could do it with white men, but not with black people. But in the Judge Priest, one of the great sequences is the anti-lynching scene, and it's Ernest Whitman, a great black actor, gives a magnificent performance along with Charlie Wininger playing Judge Priest, saving a younger black man from being lynched. And Stephen Fetchett, who was older than, played the same role he played in Judge Priest, though the judge's companion and a kind of advisor, a very, very wily and witty character, a very complex character, actually, when you study it. But the film has been horribly misunderstood and was cut against. I looked at Ford's contract. He had final cut, and Republic Pictures apparently violated his contract by cutting 10 minutes out of it and dumping it on the American market.
You mean a studio went behind a director's back and cut a film? That never happened.
they do it a lot. Well, he sued them.
They do it. Oh, man.
Yeah, well,
they do it. And then,
funny.
And they don't know how to cut. That's the problem, you know?
Well, yeah, they really hurt the film, and it played uncut in Europe. And back in a few years ago, when the film finally came out on VHS, Republic pulled a print off the shelf, and they didn't know they were releasing the uncut version, and it came out on tape, and Leonard Maltin spotted that. And then it played on DVD, so now we can see the uncut Ford film. It also has a really great sequence that Ford had been wanting to do for years of a prostitute's funeral, and the judge rallying this bigoted community, and they're also anti-prostitute. I mean, they're scornful of prostitutes, a hypocritical community, and he's preaching Christian values like the doctor and Seven Women. But the judge is a truly religious man who leads the funeral for a prostitute. So it's full of great sequences and very beautifully shot, very very moving, very funny film too.
One of the best
sequences.
Now,
you said that was your number six, Joe. Yes.
Six. Yeah.
Six. Okay. Well, in that case, we're gonna continue on number seven really quick, and then you'll wait through number six, and your next turn will be number five. So we know Greg's number seven, but what is your number seven, Sammy?
Just before I mention the title, I do own The Sunshine's Bride on Masters of Cinema. I'll be sure to listen to your commentary. I collect all the Masters of Cinema releases. I have
Great.
Them all. I will listen to your commentary as soon as I can.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Really earlier
one.
It was mentioned, John Wayne's greatest performance mentioned, mine would be his existential Ethan Edwards. And the other thing that was mentioned, well, maybe that isn't really relevant, but I'll go to my number seven, which is one that I'm sure is going to place on everybody's list. And I do like The Quiet Man, by the way. I do like it. It didn't make my top 10, but I adored Victor Young's score and the cinematography. And certainly that, you know, John Huston had his The Dead, and Ford had his The Quiet Man. My choice would be My Darling Clementine, Henry Fonda, and Linda Darnell, and Walter Brennan, the Doc Holliday, Wyatt Earp, the Earps. Of course, it played history wrong. I mean, they added characters. The real event wasn't really portrayed as it was, as we all know, but it was just such an expert piece of entertainment and craftsmanship with super performances.
Oh, man, the framing in that movie is amazing. Yeah,
framing. I mean, you can go on and on and on, but I don't want to say too much more, but that I think other people are going to have that on their list. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, it's my, number five Ford film. It's my own number five Ford film.
It's my number three. So.
okay, there you go. Okay.
Yeah, there's a scene in there, you know, when they steal the Shakespearean actor, Alan Mowbray, right? And he's trying to do the soliloquy, and they're getting the clan, you know, they're saying, like, you don't know nothing but them poems. Can you sing and all that? And then, like, Doc Holliday and Fonda go in, and Doc Holliday says, leave him alone. And then he continues, and I'm thinking, like, how beautiful that scene is. And, like, Alan Mowbray reads that soliloquy so wonderfully. Right, and then he forgets the words, and then Victor Mature, you know, continues it perfectly. And Mature once said that he was a lousy actor and had 60 films to prove it. Right, which is he was just being self-deprecating. He was a wonderful actor.
No,
really
I know. I just like to joke because I always like to tease people about the robe.
And it is, you know, but he really was, and that scene really just proved it. Like the depth he had, like most Hollywood actors and actresses back in those days really had depth to them. You know, there was real soul to them. And you don't see a lot of soul today in movie acting. But back then it was like abundance. Maybe I think we got spoiled.
Unfortunately you get wet noodles like Hollow Vaucus, wet noodles like Timothy Chalamet, but I digress.
Mm-hmm. Clementine is a wonderful picture. It really is.
Yeah.
Like I said, it's like my number three. And, you know, there's always these, like, beautiful, like, magical scenes in Ford pictures. And that's one of them, the Shakespeare scene in Clementine. Like, Joe talked about The Sun Shines Brightest before. And there's a cotillion scene, right, where everybody's, like, you know, they're all marching into the dance hall, like, perfectly, right? You know, the men, the women, they're, you know, and everybody's applauding them, the band's playing, and then all of a sudden the band just, like, you know, changes the tune just a little bit, and right as they change the tune, the men and the women just look at each other and then just break out into a perfect dance, right?
I have to wonder if Visconti didn't study that for The Leopard.
Yeah, for The Leopard, yeah. You know, that's a good point, because, you know, that whole ball scene at the end of The Leopard is extraordinary. And
I think that's one of the greatest scenes in Ford is that dance at the church dedication. It's one of the most sublime sequences in any Western or any American film. It's really an allegory for the coming of civilization in the West, and it's this skeletal church that's it isn't even a church yet, and the man who's running the dedication is not a preacher. He's Russell Simpson. He's just a guy who likes the Bible, and it's full of Ford has rituals in his films throughout his films that embody the meaning of his films. And that film with the beautiful music, Golden Slippers, which Ford used for Henry Fonda and Young Mr. Lincoln, he uses it again in Fort Apache, and then in Clementine before Fort Apache. And it's a joyous moment of pure joy. And that film, I guess I'm mixed on it because it deviates so much from history. And Ford felt the film was, he said, my children liked it. You know, I mean, I think that's kind of true. But the gunfight at the OK Corral, for example, is very grand in the Ford film. And in real life, it was a rather squalid affair that took place in an alley lot. You know, I went to Tombstone to research that. It took 30 seconds and took place in this side street. Not grand at all, but Ford made it into this majestic scene. So it is a beautiful film, but the real story is quite different. But, you know, he began to critique that later. And Liberty of Valance is almost like a kind of rethinking of Clementine from a more historically sophisticated point of view, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Well, now we're to I'll go for my seven, and my seven is Cheyenne Autumn. Which may have the most extraordinary photography in John Ford's career.
Absolutely
beautiful.
I think it's the only film shot in 70 millimeter as well.
Yeah,
it may have been. I know some people don't like that interlude, but for me, that's really, you know, you need that connective tissue. You need that. Thing in the middle. You need some levity in a movie that is that dark and serious, because it is a very serious, sad, and important film. It's wonderfully made, I wish there was a, because I know that there's, or at least I think there's still, maybe you can tell us about this, Joe, but isn't there still a few minutes of footage that hasn't found its way to the Blu-ray?
Well,
on that one
they
as well?
Restored the Dodge City sequence, which had been cut in half after the first few runs, and for the wide release, they cut it in half, and it didn't make a lot of sense, but they put it back on the VHS, but it was pan and scan. So finally on DVD, and I did the commentary on that one too, they restored the whole Dodge City sequence. There was footage cut from the film at various stages that Ford and his producer, Bernard Smith, the co-producer, really objected to. They trimmed the massacre sequence at Ford Robinson a lot, for example, and you can see stills of what they cut, but it was mutilated by the studio, and Ford had to compromise a lot to make that film because he originally wanted to make it as a, kind of a small black and white film like The Grapes of Wrath, which it resembles because it's about people leaving their home in Oklahoma and migrating. But he wanted to do it with only Native American actors who were actually of Native American ancestry, and he wanted to have them speaking their own Cheyenne language and with subtitles, and the studio wouldn't go for that, and they made him use basically Mexican American actors and Sal Mineo, who's Italian American, to play the lead roles. And actually, so when I did the commentary, I said, okay, there's some obvious flaws or compromises in this film, but let's focus on the strengths of this film, which are considerable, and not so much on the obvious flaws. And I think that Ricardo Montalban and Gilbert Roland and Dolores Del Rio and so many are very good in the film. If you can overlook the fact they're not actually Native American. But Victor Jory, for example, is a white actor who plays the chief, and nobody objects to him. He's just great. That film is so disturbing to me because it's about genocide and evil. To me, it's like Schindler's List. I mean, I feel deeply, deeply disturbed when I see that film.
Oh, it is a phenomenal, phenomenal work.
Ford is very brave again to confront the real darkest side of American life. And I have to say, I had some strange experiences.
Another
late
career gem.
Yeah, first three times I saw that film, terrible things happened to me, and I began to be. I'm not a superstitious person, but I began being wary of watching it, but I've kind of overcome that. I've watched it again recently, and if you could see it as a work of visual poetry, it really works beautifully. As you say, the cinematography, William H. Clothier, Ford thought it was the best cinematography he ever had, and he certainly had many great photographers, cinematographers, but that film is almost three-dimensional when you see it on the big screen. You have to see it on the big screen to really appreciate it, because it's a work more of visual poetry than drama. The characters are not as rich or complex as in some of his other films, but it's visual poetry, like Wagon Master in a sense, and that's what makes it great. There is a 70mm print supposedly in Sweden. I would love to see that, but I can only imagine what that must look like.
Yeah, the first time I had seen that picture was on a VHS in a terrible pan and scan, and I just remember always, and I didn't like it at all because you can't see a film like that in pan and scan because it was constantly like, a lot of shots are like two shots of people talking, so it would literally cut back and forth, which wasn't the way it was supposed to be shown, or they would do that awful like pixelation almost where like you'd see like one person and then you'd see it like pixelate to the other person, but that's because of the image.
The most famous and jarring example would be the shooting of the guy in Pulp Fiction where it's supposed to happen, where you see him, Julius standing there. He looks one way and shoots the guy while he's staring at the other one, and it's all supposed to be one image, but in the pan and scan, it's this really blurry, whoosh, whoosh, and it's awful.
Yeah.
The ending of Giant Autumn, when Sal Mineo is shot by Ricardo Montalban because he's been he's taken over his wife, his young wife, and he's also endangered the tribe by being hothead and impetuous, and they're trying to live in peace, and he's almost caused terrible destruction. He sort of tragically has to be killed to bring peace to the community. That was shot. I looked it up on my on the production records because you read in Ford books that Ford was in Monument Valley the day Kennedy was shot, and he heard the news and he gave a speech and then he disbanded the production. Well, actually, it's not true. He was in Utah shooting, and that scene was shot at the exact moment Kennedy was shot in Dallas. Sal Mineo was shot. Sal Mineo used to go around telling people that it was so strange that he was shot at that moment, and Ford, 10 minutes later, found out that Kennedy was shot. Ford loved Kennedy because he said when an Irish Catholic president was elected, it's the first time he felt like a complete American. And Ford was shattered. So he did give a very eloquent speech, and then he did three or four shots that he had to get, and then he disbanded the shooting and went back to Hollywood. And after the Kennedy funeral, he did the Dodge City sequence. But the film is just haunted by all kinds of tragedies in American life, and it's a painful, painful experience, but a really daring film, and it was, again, rejected by the American public. As Andrew Serra said, at that point in Ford's career, he recognized that his audience was no longer American. It was in Europe and Japan, basically, Germany, France, Japan, foreign countries. Ford said, I made it because people in those countries want to hear about the Indians. The Americans didn't want to hear about that at the time.
Yeah, yeah. Now, unfortunately, our other guest, Sammy, has been bumped. Blog Talk has bumped him, and unfortunately, with us now being in overtime, he may not be able to rejoin us. Hopefully he will, but we'll see. This is just one of the problems with live radio.
Live podcast.
And as such, we are now in we're now in our number six slot, and for our number six slot, I'll just start off again. I usually don't do this, but I will just say that my number six is How Green Was My Valley. And we've already discussed How Green, so no need to continue that. So I will go back again to you, Greg, and what is your number six? We know Joe's number six, so what's yours?
Okay. My number six is a film we have not mentioned yet, so that's good. It's The Long Voyage Home from 1940. The other film he did that year was Grapes of Wrath. This was follow-up to it. I think this is one of his most, you talked about expressionistic photography and everything. I think this is one of his most visually beautiful films. Greg Toland shot it, I believe. And it's also, you know, another sad, elegiac film about, you know, about the sea, about being outcasts. And that scene where Thomas Mitchell reads the letter from Smitty's wife is one of the greatest things that Ford ever shot, you know. I think you all can remember, like, they think he's a spy and he's not. He's just trying to get better, and his wife wants him to get better. So they feel ashamed after they read the letter because they just, you know, suspected him to be something he actually wasn't. And John Wayne's performance as a Swede in that film is actually very good. He does the accent very well. You know, showing again that he was a much better actor than most people give him credit for.
That's a wonderful sequence with Mildred Natwick is a wonderful Ford actress who plays this Cockney prostitute who's having to seduce this poor Swedish, rather simple guy who's they're drugging him to make him stay on. It's tragic and heartrending sequence. And Wayne is wonderful. He was coached by a Swedish actress to play that part. He's just terrific in the film.
Yeah, because there were a lot of Swedish immigrants that came over in the early part of the 20th century, including a guy named Nils Runfeldt, who was my grandfather. He came here in 1911. So, you know, and then, you know, John Quaylen was like the quintessential Swedish immigrant, you know, in many of Philip Ford's films. And one of my favorite Swedish films is called, I'm sure you two have heard of it, The Emigrants by Jan Coell.
Yeah.
And, you know, it took place around the time, I think it takes place just a little bit before my grandfather came here. But it did represent like what rural Sweden was at the time. It was not a particularly friendly place. It was harsh, you know, living there. And he came here for a better life. And you know, and again, with Ford being, you know, respectful or like sympathetic towards immigrants. So you know, there were a lot of Swedish people that came over here in the early part of the 20th century. So that's represented in that film.
Yeah,
and,
The Emigrants was the first film I saw shooting. Mike Wilmington and I heard they were shooting it in Wisconsin, so we got on the bus and went there and showed up, walked across the field, and there they were. And we spent a day watching them shoot the scene on the train as they're traveling to Minnesota. And we interviewed Max Vincito and Lee Vollman and Jan Trell. And that was our first my first experience watching a film being shot. And very beautiful Western. Not exactly Fordian, but elegiac in its own way and very beautiful, but kind of modern shooting style. It's almost like a documentary style Western, you know.
Mm-hmm. And the ending of The Emigrants is really beautiful and perfect, where, you know, he just sits under the tree that he's marked for himself after, you know, coming out thousands of miles. Because I remember he was looking for a specific place, and his other immigrants, like Alan Edwall plays one of them, and he just says, "Well, just stay here with us. You've come a long way to stay." And he goes, "If I come 1,000 miles, I can walk a few more." And then he finds this place that he had dreamed in his mind, and that's where he settles in, and then the film ends. It's a beautiful ending. I haven't seen a film in ages. I should watch it.
Well, I'll just say that it's not my favorite Ford film, but it is based on works by my favorite playwright, Eugene O'Neill.
Yes,
so,
Mr. O'Neill.
It is astounding
how
Ford shot
well.
That. He shot that on a soundstage, and it's all taking place at sea. And there is no shooting at sea. He did one or two shots on a dock in San Pedro, I believe. But it's extremely expressionistic. The lighting is amazing, the Greg Tolan lighting. And that's the film in which Ford shared his directing credit card with Greg Tolan as cinematographer, and Orson Welles imitated that with Citizen Kane. People tend to forget Welles's credit card. It says Orson Welles, direction, production, cinematography, Greg Tolan. He was kind of paying homage to Ford and Tolan. It is one of the most stunning pieces of cinematography ever. Grapes of Wrath is a piece of cinematography, but in a more kind of quasi-documentary style, very different style.
Yeah. Now we've done our number sixes there, and I've mentioned my number five. So Joe, what is your number five?
Well, Fort Apache, and that film, in some ways, I should say, is my number one because it's the film that turned me on to John Ford. I had seen a few Ford films before that, but when I was back home over Christmas in 1967, I watched it on television, and it just knocked me out, partly because the first scene is a little stagecoach riding through Monument Valley, and Ford has his camera rise up above the stagecoach to take in this huge mesa, and then it comes back to this tiny stagecoach, and that's when I sort of fell in love with John Ford, because I understood what he was saying, that the squabbling inside the stagecoach was insignificant compared to the eternal values of the land. And then the film is such a revisionist view of America. And when I was a kid, I saw a Western almost every day on television. There was a TV show in Milwaukee called Foreman Tom's Jamboree. I'd see it 4 o'clock. And then on weekends, I'd usually see a Western. So that was my big thing. But when I was a kid, I used to wonder, how come these Indians are always losing and getting beaten? It bothered me, and I didn't understand it. And I was a little guy, and I was getting beaten up all the time, and I was for the underdog. And one day I saw a film on Foreman Tom's Jamboree where the Indians won, and I was ecstatic. I don't know what it was. It could have been Fort Apache, because there are very few films from that era where the Indians win. And not only do they win the battle, but they're the good guys in the film. They're the heroes of the film. It's a very subversive film. It's true to life, true to American history. And it knocked me out. Frank Nugent's screenplay is one of the two screenplays that influenced me the most. The other was Citizen Kane by Herman Mankiewicz and Orson Welles. I was trying to learn how to be a screenwriter, and Nugent's script is like a novel. It's so rich. It takes in a lot of characters, including women and men on the fort, and it's a very multi-ethnic community, and the Indians are very heroic, and it's about a racist commanding officer who's a madman, as Ward Bond calls Henry Fonda's commander, who's based on Custer. Ford, in the 30s, wanted to make a film on Custer called Glory Hunter, which tells you what kind of take he would have had on Custer. He told me, he said, the cavalry weren't all American boys, you know. He said, you just mentioned Custer. That was a pretty goddamn silly expedition. And they wouldn't let him make a film attacking Custer back then. There was a film called They Died With Their Boots On, Royal Walsh directed, which is a very stirring, beautifully made film, but it's historically insane because it tries to portray Custer as a heroic pro-Indian figure, which is a total warping of history. But so Ford
I've not seen that picture. And
well,
I don't know if I should.
Well, it influenced Ford in some ways with its imagery and the music and stuff, but it's totally different from Fort Apache. But Ford had to fictionalize the character. It's called Colonel Thursday to tell the truth. And but, you know, the thing is, I found a letter Ford wrote that year in 1948. A woman wrote to him and said, how come since you come back from the war, you're making only Westerns, basically, more or less, mostly Westerns? And Ford wrote back and he said, well, you know, when you're dealing with serious issues, social issues, it's the only way you can get away with it in Hollywood today is do it as a Western, because nobody pays attention to Westerns. And that's a very interesting insight into Ford, because literally nobody paid attention to what Westerns were saying. And they didn't care about them, and they underrated them. But you could deal with racism and criticism of the military and genocide, et cetera, in a film like Fort Apache and get away with it, slipping it under the nose of the studios. And so I was just really knocked out by Ford's audacity and honesty in that film, and that the film means an awful lot to me, and I've always loved watching it. And it also has wonderful humor too. It's a very rich film in comedy, drama, a great visual style, wonderful battle sequences. John Wayne is great. He plays, contrary to the myth of John Wayne being an Indian hater in Westerns, he's the guy who is sympathetic to the Indians and tries to bring peace. He makes a deal with Cochise to bring peace, and Henry Fonda crassly says, we're going to violate the the deal and attack them. And Wayne says, no man's going to make a liar out of me, sir. And Fonda says, you know, there's no question of honor between an American soldier and Cochise. And Wayne says, there is to me, sir. And that's where you really love the John Wayne character. But the tragedy is, at the end of the film, he kind of acquiesces to the military ethos, and they march out on another mission. And it's a tragic film about American history. It anticipates Liberty Valance. And Wayne's character, as one of my students pointed out, should have stopped the colonel from killing all his men and unjustly attacking the Indians, but he failed to do that. He should have arrested him or shot him, but he didn't. But that's the tragedy of that film. It's a very profound film.
Now, I have heard from Sammy, everyone, and he's unfortunately unable to come in back in because of technical problems, but he has sent me his list. His number 6 would have been Young Mr. Lincoln, and his number 5 would have been Wagon Master. So now that we have, and of course my number 5 was My Darling Clementine. So what is your number 5, Greg?
Well, the film following Fort Apache, She Wore a Yellow Ribbon. Pretty much everybody's like talked about why it's such a great film. John Wayne's wonderful performance as a he's playing a 60-year-old man very effectively. The beautiful cinematography, the stirring theme song. I always love that song, She Wore a Yellow Ribbon in the U.S. Cavalry. It's one of my favorite old time, maybe not a folk song, but kind of a way, I guess it is a folk song, but very stirring song. And the whole trilogy is really beautiful, and, people have the various ones that they like more, but all three of the films are wonderful. And I just like She Wore a Yellow Ribbon the best of the three. And we were talking about movie trilogies. There's a meme going around Facebook. You guys have probably seen it about Film I Love, Film I Loathe, my favorite trilogy. And most people are mentioning maybe Star Wars trilogy or Kislev's trilogy, but people should maybe mention the Ford trilogy, Fort Apache, She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, and Rio Grande, which is a wonderful trilogy. So yeah, She Wore a Yellow Ribbon is my number 5.
So now we get to the real top, number 4. And I'm going to go with the person who unfortunately is not here to be with us, and that's Sammy. And his number 4 would have been Stagecoach, which we haven't discussed much, if at all, tonight. And we'll get back to that one in a bit. But my number 4 is The Grapes of Wrath, which we also haven't discussed yet. So do we have anything to say about either of those real quick? Because we are closing in on only having about a half hour and still several films to get through. So briefly.
Well, when I was interviewing Ford for an hour, he was very gruff, and it was the last day of his career. He retired in the course of my interview. He realized his career was over. It was very sad, but the only time he smiled in that hour was when I told him my father's favorite film was Stagecoach. And my dad was a film critic and for the Milwaukee Journal, and it is a wonderful screenplay by Dudley Nichols, very rich array of characters, and a beautifully constructed film. My reservations about that are it uses Monument Valley rather meagerly, although it caused quite a stir by revealing Monument Valley to the film audience. Some powerful shots, but the principal actors were not in Monument Valley. Ford used a lot of process shots, which bother me in the film, because I like the extensive use of Monument Valley and the Cavalry trilogy and The Searchers, for example. But it is a really gripping film about outsiders taking the viewpoint of socially disreputable characters, which Ford and Nichols really reveled in. And they also made it a kind of a political allegory of the New Deal and the economic situation of the 1930s. And, of course, it's the film that made John Wayne a star. Ford designed it as a star-creating vehicle, even though Wayne had been around for quite a while. But he had been foundering in B Westerns for a while, and Ford elevated him into his stature. He didn't let him say much, but his physical presence is very powerful and strong, and Ford cured him of a lot of his bad habits, mm-hmm. according to Claire Trevor, who was she's terrific in the film too, and she said that Ford would grab Wayne by the chin, for example, said, "Don't move your chin so much. You act with your eyes, not with your chin," you know, and things like that.
Well, you know, this is probably the perfect time to put in a clip, which, Joe, you had actually suggested this, and I thought it was an awesome idea. I was going to use this for, a way to kind of end the show, but, I think that since you mentioned, you know, that you interviewed him on the last day of his career, why don't we play a clip of you interviewing John Ford and kind of let the old man join us for a moment and talk about his favorite films of his.
Right. You seem to like to make movies about the past.
Do I?
Well, I guess so.
I don't know. This is really a lousy interview, really.
Yeah.
Hmm?
Well,
I'm not going to get much out of this.
Well, I guess I'm being over-intellectualizing. Does it bother you to be interviewed?
Mm-hmm.
How does it make you feel?
Oh, I don't like to be interviewed. I mean, the only reason that I'm letting you interview me is that you came here and your name is McBride. The people from County Mayo, otherwise I'll tell you to go to hell. And that's the only reason I'm being interviewed now.
Mm-hmm. Well,
is that a good answer?
Oh, yeah. Hit it right on the head, I guess.
Hmm?
That hit it right on the head. One movie of yours I like a lot is The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. Did you, you must have liked that story, didn't you?
Yeah, I know it's a pretty good story.
Some people thought it was a kind of a summing up of your attitudes about the West.
I don't know.
Do you like The Searchers a lot?
I enjoy doing it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, The Searchers is a good picture, made a lot of money. That's the ultimate end.
Mm-hmm. When you first started directing John Wayne, in Stagecoach, when his first starring role for you, was he a natural actor?
Mm-hmm. He still is.
Mm-hmm.
He's very natural.
How did you have to direct him, give him a lot more to do in the earlier pictures?
Mm-hmm.
No?
He's just a natural actor.
Mm-hmm. You don't like to tell actors very much about what to do.
Who?
You don't like to tell actors a lot of details, do you, about their... You don't like to give them a lot of instructions anyway, do you?
No.
Some directors do, though.
Do they?
Chaplin, Lubitsch.
Huh?
Chaplin and Lubitsch, people like that acted out all the parts, you know.
I'd like to see them as acting out. Must have been funny.
Did the story of Three Godfathers, was that one of your... It seems like a very personal story. I like that movie a lot.
What do you mean by personal?
Well, you did it a couple times. It seemed like a story that meant a lot to you.
Mm-hmm. Well, MGM bought the story and they wanted me to make it, so I made it.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed making it. And that's pretty about finished our interview. Mac, I've got a lot of work to do. Today's an awfully busy day for me.
Okay.
I've got
to... Well, I appreciate the...
It's now 3:30 and I'm waiting, but I've got to call up Rome.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's fine. I've got a good interview.
That's a good piece of news. I'm...
No, this is very good. I'm sorry I asked some silly questions.
Well, it isn't that, but everybody asks the same questions.
Mm-hmm.
and suddenly say, geez, I'm being interviewed. But all you people, I mean, all, you know, you all ask the same questions. I'm sick and tired of trying to answer them because I don't know the answers. I'm just a hard-nosed, hard-working ex-director. And I'm trying to retire gracefully.
So you don't like people asking you about your old movies very much?
No, I've forgotten them. I don't know what they're about. I'm just trying to live out my life in peace and comfort and quiet.
But do you ever watch your old movies very much?
Hmm?
Do you watch your old movies?
Hmm?
No? I heard you you watch Sunshine's Bright every once in a while, though. But...
I would if I could get a print of it, but I don't. I've never seen it.
Hmm.
I've never seen it. I don't know where you get a print of it. Are you cold?
A little bit, yes, Mr. Ford. It's a little chilly in my office.
She's always kicking. No, I like the Sunshine's Bright. I like the sun. I'm going to look around and see if there's a 16-millimeter copy if I'd like to run it somewhere.
I heard they cut something out of that, too, I guess.
Oh, yeah, they ruined that. Well, they couldn't ruin it.
Great movie.
But they cut a lot out of it.
What kind of scenes did they cut, do you remember?
I don't know.
Yeah. Was there anything about the judge's wife? I was trying to...
He was a widower at the time.
But in the way the movie came out, there was no mention of her at all. And I thought there might have been in your version, the original.
I don't know what they cut out.
That doesn't... Does that bother you very much when they cut something out?
Yeah.
No.
You're working with a stupid lot of people. I mean, the executive producers, so what the hell you got to expect it?
Weren't you the producer on a lot of your movies, though?
I said the executive producers.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, when
That's
you...
the head of the studio.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, a fellow named Herbert Yates.
Well, what about when you had Argosy Pictures? Didn't they, did
yeah,
you control it more?
Yeah, I had full control of the cutting of that, so.
Uh-huh. Didn't you always try to get full control of the cutting?
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't there any way you could get control of a film like The Sunshine's Bright?
I was away at the time. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Yates cut it, and they cut out certain things. I think he cut out... what he cut out, he cut out a lot of the black stuff, the Negro stuff.
Oh.
Not a lot of it, but, you know. But there were climatic scenes, and he cut them out and hurt the picture.
They still played a big part in the movie, didn't
they? Huh?
The black people still played a big part in that movie.
Yeah.
Why did he cut that stuff out?
I don't know.
I think it was...
Mac, you're actually asking questions I can't answer.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to say au revoir.
Yeah.
God bless you.
Thank you.
Country Mayo Gajil.
Aaron Gobra.
Country Mayo Gobra.
And, folks, that is John Ford. Speaking about his own work with our own Joe McBride doing the interview. So, I have to say that as soon as you suggested it, I was like, oh, that's an awesome idea. That was great to have that clip. So thank you for letting us
Mr. Ford,
that.
It sounded like Mr. Ford was nicer to you than he was to a lot of other people who interviewed him.
Yeah, I mean,
I remember like...
My first interview in Hollywood, can you imagine, 23 years old, and I mean, he was an impossible guy to interview generally, although, you know, once in a while he'd come up with an interesting comment, a good piece of advice or revelation, but a lot of it was, I don't know, I don't remember, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's interesting to compare it to the ending of The Fablemans, where the Spielberg young character representing Spielberg goes to see Ford, and Ford is gruff, but there are moments, flashes of warmth in that. It's very, very true to what I experienced with Ford, that he gave me a really hard time, but there was, warmth at the end, and I gave him a book I dedicated to him. Persistence of Vision was a collection of film criticism that our Wisconsin Film Society put out, and I dedicated it to him. And he looked at it. He had to hold it right up to his eye, you know, because he couldn't see very well. And he said, "Oh, that's sweet." So that was a nice moment. But it was a struggle to interview for it, I'll tell you. But it was invaluable to me as a future biographer to have an hour with him, more for his body language and things like that than from what he actually said. But I was pumping him, you know, and I didn't quite know how to get around him. But a lot of it was, you know, he seemed kind of insecure, oddly enough, around a young film scholar who knew his work. And I thought that was interesting. Here's a guy who's been in film since 1914 and the greatest film director of all time, and he's somewhat insecure around it. Young cineast, but he was uncomfortable with the interview process, and I came to respect that. At first, I was bothered by that, but I realized over the years that directors today, generally, they give like 100 interviews about their new film, and they tell you how to watch it. And Ford didn't do that. He felt you should just make up your own mind about his film, and he wasn't going to explain it to you. And I have a lot of respect for that now.
Yeah, I do too. A lot of modern directors are like too media friendly in many ways.
Yeah,
they do too many interviews. They whittle things. Okay, here's what, you know, there's always that first question that they always ask. Take us through the process, you know.
Yeah.
And what the process is, just we just, you know, we wrote a script, we got money for it, we made the film. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really kind of the process, you know. There's really nothing deep
about
it.
How'd you shoot it? With a camera.
With a camera.
Yeah, with a camera. And we shot, you know, we shot on 35mm or 16 or 70, or we shot it digitally with the red camera, you know.
Yeah.
Was it improvised? No, I wrote the script. I wrote a script. That's what it says, written by, you know.
Yeah. When I asked Howard Hawks, I said, what do you think of improvisation? Because that was the big buzzword of a lot of young people at the time. And he said, what the hell do they think a director does? In other words, you don't just film the script exactly, you bring it to life. But,
right.
You know, the thing about Ford was he also played a role, as Olive Carey told me, who knew him longer than anybody else I had interviewed. She said he was a consummate actor. He was always acting. He was playing this gruff character to protect himself from scrutiny. He wasn't going to tell you what was in his heart and mind. For that, you have to see his films. And he was a very sensitive man who was protecting his sensitivity and his artistry, because in Hollywood in those days, if you had run around and talked about your feelings and your artistry, they'd kill you, you know, as they did to Welles and Stroheim and other people like that, and who were more open about their artistry.
Probably why they were all pretty fond of each other's work. They sensed kindred spirits to a degree, I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they all respected Ford as the master.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, moving past this wonderful thing, because I do want to get through the rest of this, and we've only got about 25 minutes left. So I will go with you, Greg. What is your number four?
Number four has already been mentioned numerous times. Green was my valley.
How Green is my valley. Okay, so
yeah.
My number four is The Grapes of Wrath, which we've talked a little bit about, which ends up having been Sammy's number one. All I can say is that there have been moments where any of my top four Ford films have been my number one Ford film. Grapes is, you know, I'm going to say that I like it more than the book. I'm going to say that. I think it is a better work in some ways than the book. The book is great. The movie's better. And I don't say that very often. Everyone talks about Fonda. They talk about, I literally just had a brain fart and her name just escaped me, the one that won the Oscar for it, that played Majo.
Jane Darwell. Yeah.
Yep, Jane Darwell.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the one that I think gave the absolute best performance. Can anyone guess who I think the best performance was?
Russell Simpson Carradine? Is the father?
Nope.
John Carradine is the reverend?
I think it was Carradine. I think Carradine's performance is really, truly marvelous. I am not sure that movie would have worked without what he brought to that part.
Well, you know, it's interesting. To me, it's a very radical film, and I did a lot of research on that, and I read the book again. I agree with you that the film is better than the novel. There's a certain amount of pretension in the novel that Ford and Nunnally Johnson, the screenwriter, cut out. And Steinbeck was very concerned with selling the book to Hollywood because it was controversial, and he thought they'd water it down and ruin it. And but he wrote a letter to his agent after he saw the film, and he was stunned. He said it was a tougher thing than the book, partly because film is a photographic medium, and it's like a documentary. You know, Ford and Toland and their coworkers really made it look so real.
The producer of the film had asked one of his guys to go out and do a little investigating and say, is it really as bad as the book and the movie are making it? And he said, oh, sir, it's way worse than this.
Yeah, that was Daryl Zanuck, the head of the studio. And he was a conservative guy, but he had a lot of integrity. And another interesting discovery I found was that the reason the film got made was Fox was controlled by the Chase National Bank, and you'd think a bank would be against a film like that, but the wife of the head of the Chase National Bank was a big fan of the book, and she told her husband, you should do that film. That's why the film got made. And Zanuck did a wonderful thing. When the film was finished, I wish more executives would be like this. He saw it in his private screening room, and he turned to his aide at the end of the film, and he said, ship it. That's all he said. They didn't have a preview. Could you imagine if they had previewed that, or if RKO had previewed Citizen Kane or whatever? You know, in other words, just put it out there. Have faith in the film, and the public responded to the truth of the Grapes of Wrath and the strong depiction of the family and the outsider played by Henry Fonda, who gives, you know, all-time career performance in that film. It's just a great film in every regard.
Yeah. It's a marvelous, marvelous, marvelous movie. So, Joe, what is your number four?
Well, number four, I put The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. I taught a course on that film recently.
That's my number two.
San Francisco State. Yeah, I'm teaching courses on how to write about films, and I thought, well, the best way to do it is take one film and really dig into it deeply. And so I had a course on Liberty Valance where we read the short story by Dorothy M. Johnson and really studied the film, and the students found it fascinating. And I thought they would find it relatively easy to analyze, but they found it difficult because it's such a complex film and paradoxical, and a lot of them don't know much about Westerns, but they, you know, I tried to bring them up to speed. But the film, one of the things that's remarkable, it's a film that analyzes itself. It's a great screenplay by Willis Goldbeck and James Warner Bella. And it's such an intellectual screenplay. It discusses ideas and issues in a very sophisticated way and analyzes its own storytelling. And it's a very meta-Western. It's about creation of myth and how Westerns create myth and distort history. And it's a critique of the entire genre. And one critic said it was John Ford's going out of business sale. I thought that was a great comment. You know, he's saying farewell to the Western genre. Of course, then he made Shine Autumn after that, which was a very different kind of Western for him because it was focused on Native Americans. But Liberty Valance is really about the genre and the whole what it means in American history. It's so central to our country. How we see ourselves in our history. And a lot of our history is just lies. you know, I mean, I critique history. I wrote a book called Political Truth. Came out last year, the media and the assassination of President Kennedy, about how the mainstream media have been lying to us about that event since 1963. And so much of our history that we think is true is just a myth. And Ford gets into that. He was so critical of a lot of the falsity of American history by that time. and what had happened to our country. He really deplored a lot of things that were going on. And also, he had been one of the great mythmakers of the West. You know, we talked about Clementine was turning a rather squalid Western gunfight into a grand romantic myth, and I think Ford felt sort of uncomfortable about that. But Fort Apache and some other Ford films examined the reality behind the legends that we create about history. And so Liberty Valance is just a magnificent film, deeply, deeply moving. So many Ford films are so moving, it's kind of hard to single one out. But the last scene or two of Liberty Valance is so heartbreaking. You know,
yep.
I mean, it just really
tears you
up. But, you
know, it's my number four. And some days it's my number three Western.
Yeah, it's my number two Ford film.
Yeah.
You know, I found a letter. This will interest your listeners because it's news. I was in Ireland a couple of years ago, and I met with a friend of Ford's. Actually, he was a kind of a distant relative of Ford. And Ford had written a letter to his relative, Lord Michael Callanan, who worked with him on The Quiet Man and Rising of the Moon. And during post-production on Liberty Valance, he wrote this letter, and Callanan's son gave me this. Redmond Morris is his name. He's a film producer. And Ford said, I'm editing Liberty Valance. I think it's my best picture. He said, strangely enough, it's a picture aimed at women. It's a Western aimed at women, is the way he put it. And Mike Wilmington and I analyzed the film back in the early 70s, and we pointed out that Hallie, who is played by Vera Miles, who was one of Ford's favorite actresses, makes all the important decisions in the film, including the husband has asked Jimmy Stewart to tell what really happened, you know, back in the gunfight that made him a heroic figure. And he looks at his wife. He doesn't know what to do, and she nods. It's a momentous decision. Tell the truth about this. They're exposing the fraud, their whole life and his career based on fraud. And all through the film, she's the one who gets John Wayne to kill Liberty Valance. Her husband doesn't know that she's doing that. And all through the film, she's the one who makes all the important decisions. So, and her scenes are the heart of the film, and the emotional impact of the film is seen through the woman. So when people, you know, that one of my students had this view, people have such cliched views of Westerns. They thought Westerns were all male, preening, macho behavior. Women in Westerns were not interesting. So I when I heard that from them, I had a whole class where I took like 10 Westerns with powerful, independent women in them. And I showed these scenes one after another, and they were kind of stunned. Wait a minute, the Western genre has all these great female characters? And I said, well, you know,
yes.
half the pioneers were strong, independent women. My ancestors yeah. were strong. I mean, one of my great-grandmother, who I actually knew, drove a stagecoach in the West. And, you know, they were tough women back then, very interesting female characters. And the genre is full of them. And so that kind of illuminated this for people. But it's sad that modern audiences don't know much about the greatest American genre.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of sad that like they don't know that, like, if you look at Hollywood history, and Adam and I have talked about this, and how, you know, it's much more, you know, complex and progressive than, like, you know, it gets people just dismiss it like outright. It's like, oh, it was all this it was all, there were no independent women characters back then, and of course there were. They're all over the
yeah.
place. Yeah, you know?
They're full of
they're everywhere.
The genre is full of
and
them.
If you go back to the silent era, you have women directors, you have women producers. United Artists was founded by Mary Pickford. You know, if you want,
well, you know, as Harry Truman said, history that's new is all the history you don't know.
Well,
yeah.
Also, you know, when you mentioned women directors, Tony Slide, a great film historian, did a documentary called, I think it was called The Silent Feminists, and there were 30 women directing films in Hollywood in the silent period. And some of them were Universal, and one of them, Lois Weber, was a really good director, a very important director, and Ford was her assistant director at one point at Universal, and there was another woman directed a Western at Universal, and it still exists, and There were, you know, in the early pioneer days of Hollywood, it was like the old West. Women were given a lot of chances to make films, and then that all kind of dried up when Talking Pictures came in. Pretty much, it was mostly Dorothy Arzner for a long time. But Ford respected strong women, and he always had a lot of good. I taught an entire course called "Women in the Films of John Ford," which one of my colleagues said is counterintuitive, but there are a lot of great women in Ford films, and I did a whole course on it.
So now we're at three, and I think that pretty much we've all covered this. So we will just do our three. So Joe, what are your, just real quick, from three
well,
to one, what are your top three?
The one we haven't talked about is one of my three, but my number three is Seven Women, which we've talked about. Number two is They Were Expendable. Number one is Wagon Master. And I'd say my two favorite Fords are Wagon Master and Expendable. Expendable is a really great film. It's a World War II film made toward the end of the war when they could be more truthful and honest, and it's about the greatest defeat in American history up to that time, the loss of the Philippines in the war, and it's about the PT boats. John Bulkley, Admiral John Bulkley, who was a model for the Robert Montgomery character, and Admiral Bulkley, I said, the film looks to me like a documentary, and he said, a documentary, yes, but with good actors. And he said, Montgomery was awfully good. He looks like me, and he acts like me, and a good performance by Montgomery. But Bulkley said to me a very, very candid thing. He said, I took 111 men to the Philippines and came back with 9. And he said, I was very bitter about the whole thing because we couldn't defend the Philippines. There was no way to do it, but we had to do it, he said, to show that the people in Asia that we were standing up for them, but we were not ready and we were not able to do it. And it was a tragedy. It's a great tragedy. And so it's a very stark and somber film, very elegiac, very beautiful film about sacrifice, which is a great Ford theme that is part of the reason Ford is not fashionable today, because how many of us would sacrifice our lives for our country? I'd say very few. There are people who volunteer to join the military. There are some, but it is not something most people understand today. But Ford films are full of sacrifices of religious quality to that. And the film, to me, has the greatest black and white cinematography ever. It's Joseph H. August, who's my favorite cameraman, who worked with Ford 14 times. And the film, it looks like a documentary, but it's also simultaneously very expressionistic and very rich cinematography. Very beautiful film and a very sad, moving, tragic film with a great performance by Donna Reed as an Army nurse. And Wayne is terrific, and Montgomery is just magnificent in the lead role. And it's all about, fighting for a cause, even though you're going to go down to defeat. And it's a tribute to people who do that. And Ford was kind of summing up the meaning of the war at the end. And it's not a gung-ho, flag-waving war film at all. It's the opposite, actually. And that's one reason it's so valuable to watch it, I think.
And just to repeat, my own top three are The Searchers, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, and The Quiet Man. While the unfortunately booted because of technical difficulties, Sammy had How Green Was My Valley, The Searchers, and The Grapes of Wrath as his top three. So that leaves us with you, Gregory. What are your top three, very quickly?
Well, they've all been mentioned, but I'll mention them again. Third one, number three is My Darling Clementine. Number two is The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. And number one is They Were Expendable.
Number one. That's great to hear.
Expendable is just outside my top 10. I think I have it like maybe 15, 16, somewhere in there. It's good, but it just, I don't know, there's just other ones that speak to me more. But yeah, go on, sorry.
Yeah, Expendable was the first film that got me. It was the film that got me into John Ford, and I still can watch it, and I still really admire it. I had seen The Searchers in a film class. I didn't really get into it at the time. I was young, we'll say. And then I also watched Cheyenne Autumn. I mentioned that earlier. I saw it on a bad VHS pan and scan. So I didn't really register, but then, you know, so when I watched They Were Expendable, I was like, wow, this is a great film. And a lot of shots, you know, if you ever see Ozu films, Ford frames shots in They Were Expendable that look like Ozu. And, I picked up on that, and I thought that was kind of interesting. And both had, like, a really kind of peaceful, like, tranquility in many of their pictures, you know. So, and I know Kurosawa loved John Ford. He admired him very much. They got to meet at one time. But, you know, there's not much known about Ozu personally. I don't think he did many interviews. There's a few lying around. So he must have seen some John Ford pictures. So,
Ozu was a big fan of How Green Was My Valley in particular. He was a big Ford fan, actually. Expendable, you're right. The visual style is so poetic and so moving. It's also Lindsay Anderson's favorite film of all time. He was the first really important Ford critic, and he just worshipped that film. And he made an interesting comment. He said, you couldn't make that film today for a lot of reasons. He said, for one, you'd have to recreate MGM. I thought that was a really interesting comment. Because the film, even though it takes place in the Philippines, it looks so authentic. It was made in Florida, and it's an MGM film, and it's not glossy like a typical MGM film that you'd think of, but it's shot, and Ford had been through war from 1941 onward, and it traveled throughout the world and seen every theater of combat, and he covered D-Day. He was he organized the filming of D-Day, and he had seen everything, and so he knew how to restage battle to make it look authentic with actors who carried off being authentic, and so many good minor roles too that flesh out the film, and just the atmosphere and the mood, the poetic mood of the film. It's a visual poem, image after image, as I think it was Anderson said, is full of nobility and beauty. And it's interesting you focus on the serenity and the peaceful quality. That's kind of paradoxical for a war film, but that's true. There's a kind of
it's a damn sight better movie than, say, Guerrilla in the Philippines.
Yeah.
And I'm a big fan, but that is not Fritz's best movie.
No. There's a documentary that I'm in called Becoming John Ford. I was an advisor. Nick Redmond made this. It's on the Ford at Fox set. Julie Kirgo wrote it, and Lem Dobbs is in it, who's a very good screenwriter, and he said, you know, he was praising They Were Expendable, and this was some years ago. He said, just think of a lot of Ford titles are in the past tense. She wore yellow ribbon. They were expendable. He's talking about mourning people who are gone. How Green Was My Valley. And then he said, Hollywood today, if they would make a war movie, they'd probably call it The Expendables. And sure enough, a few years later, they made a movie called The Expendables, you know. That tells you the difference in a nutshell between Ford and modern Hollywood, I think.
Yep. Yeah. And I think, you know, right there, that's a good place to stop. It's, it's Ford in a nutshell. A respect and reverence for the past, an interest in getting the audience to consider their past and their place, not necessarily in it, but their connection to it, how their reference to it, where they are in reference to it.
Traditions that made us who we are, and we need to remember. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, we could have done a second show. We could have done, like, two shows, done one on 10 through 6 and then another one on 5 through 1 and really dug deep. But, hey, you know, that would have been maybe stretching all of our energies and time. But as always, I want to thank you guys for coming on. I want to thank the audience for listening. I do want to thank Sammy for coming on, and Darn You Blog Talk for cutting him off. Of course, we'll have you, both of you, back at some point in the future. There's plenty of great directors coming up later this year, so I'm sure we'll talk about that and see if either of you are interested in any of those. please come back in 2 weeks for the George Lucas episode. That should be quite fun, as should the Young Indy episode. That one may end up being a two-hander. Me versus Aaron White. All I will say is one of us is much more fond of the show than the other one. Because right now it's got me and one guest. So that'll be quite interesting to see what happens there. Yep. This was great. This was everything I was hoping it would be, you know, getting to go in and not just do like 30 seconds like it felt like we got last time. And once again, Joe, thank you so much for letting us use that clip of you interviewing Ford and him talking about his movies. That was great. So on the count of three, we will say goodnight and put this one to bed. One,
good night,
two, three, good night.
Good night,
thank
everybody.
You. Thank you. A lot of fun.